I'm going to call the meeting to order. Thank you all for being prompt. I understand some of you want to get out of here on time and come back to the year again, so we do our very best. This is the Lazard Sands Outdoor Heritage Council on November 14th. Getting to the max day. I'm sure you're all getting as many emails as I am. But the first thing on our agenda is to review and approve the agenda that is sitting in front of you. Someone care to make a motion to do that? Is there any discussion? Any suggestions for change? If not, by approval by saying aye.
Aye.
All right. Opposed? Motion carries. We have the minutes of our September 20th meeting in front of you. If someone would like to make a motion, that would be great.
Mr. Chair, I'll listen in.
Any discussion, corrections, suggestions? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Any conflicts of interest, your past conflict disclosure in terms of projects are still on record, so is there anything anyone has that's new in terms of a conflict they'd like to discuss There are none? Great. We'll move directly into the Executive Director's report.
The pastries look great.
Thank you, Danny.
Thank you very much. You have four documents in your package I'd like to talk about. One is a three-hole punch accomplishment plan that is a replacement. It's for the accelerated shallow lakes and wetland enhancement phase. This is rather simple. Take this and put it in your books in the appropriate place. The next thing that we have is an email memo from Scott Rawl for your interest. As you may recall, Scott was concerned about attachment E and its effect on programs and their ability to move forward in timely fashion. Scott and Dave Shad spoke, and Scott wrote a report on his conversations with Dave. I think it's fair to characterize the finding that Scott had is that things are acceptable and that there is reason for the attachment he requirements. So if there are any questions on that, Scott's not here today. We can try to get them to him. Also, at the last meeting, the council members raised concern about grazing and specifically emergency grazing and requested background information on grazing policy at the state level and grazing policies at the federal level. Now, I'll speak very briefly about this. You have the descriptive material, one for the state and one for the federal programs, in your packet. The state question revolves around WMAs primarily, and WMAs, the purpose is defined in Minnesota Statutes 86A. Basically, you manage a wildlife management area for wildlife exclusively. You don't manage it for cattle or things like that. In looking at implementing that policy, I think it's fair to say the department has found that within the construct of a grazing management plan directed at habitat then, where the purpose is habitat and grazing is a mechanism, it's acceptable. It has to be within the management plan stipulated, defined, things like numbers of animals, amount of time, things like that. It has to be in the plan. So there is currently limited grazing. I think that before the day is over, it might be useful to come back to this and what I'm going to go into next. Because the question that's in front of us is whether or not we write some sort of requirement in our appropriations law that deals with grazing on the property we buy. Board of Water and Soil Resources, in combination with the federal government, USDA and NRCS, is a little different. And it's important to understand that that program has two easements involved. One is a federal easement with a term of 30 years. The second one is a state easement with a term of perpetuity. The easements do not take effect simultaneously. They take effect sequentially. The federal easement taking effect first, sitting in place for 30 years, dissolving, so to speak, and the state easement coming in its place for the rest of the time. They basically have different approaches to managing grazing. The federal easement allows emergency paying and grazing. It is a condition that we are evidently bound to. After 30 years, the state policy takes place. It's a policy of the Board of Water and Soil Resources, which does not allow emergency grazing. So that's the situation that we're facing. The question about the federal policy is twofold. One, can the state implement a policy that overrides federal policy? That's a difficult task. And I think that there's questions on both sides, federal and state, about the advisability of having a policy that applies to state land or federal land based on the source of income. That it is just because it's from the Outdoor Heritage Fund, it has these special conditions, so we can manage some wildlife management areas some ways and other ones other ways. And what is the effect of that on actually carrying out policy, and what is the effect of that on public understanding and that sort of thing? And the general advice, when we talked with staff, your staff talked with the staff of the agencies, was it's not a good idea to have special rules and regulations based on the source of money. It's better to have rules and regulations based on the management unit. So I don't know exactly where that leaves us. I think the question is something we have to come back to later today when we talk about things that we want written into the bill, and it's something that we may want to look at in December and as a written policy, and let staff think about it a little while, and just express your general parameters as to what you think we ought to do. Rick?
I'm sorry, before you move into the next area, I think the summary is pretty detailed. The emergency paying grazing that was authorized this year was because of winter kill alfalfa in southeastern Minnesota. So it should be interesting to see exactly how much is documented of how much winter kill occurred, because I think they have to report that now this fall. So it would be interesting to go back and see exactly how much loss there was that occurred to temperature rather than plow. Secondly, it has 28 sites totaling 399 acres that are harvested. It's my understanding that some of the WMAs that were open were in Northwestern, so nowhere near the alleged loss. So I think the concern the council raised earlier is the ubiquitous or the ongoing emergency that occurs every year that essentially just allows more hay and grazing. Because there's, let's face it, folks, there's going to be another emergency next year and next year and next year. So, which moves us to almost a Western-style publicly funded grazing system on our public lands for emergency purposes. So I'd like to flesh out, you know, not right now, but maybe the department to come back to us and show us exactly where the haying occurred. Because with haying, you can sell those bales. If you're adjacent with grazing, you can move the cattle on there. But I know the policy said no selling, but if you're 200 or 300 miles away from the loss, are you curious where that hay went?
Any other comments on this?
Thank you, David. I just wonder that how much oversight there is on this grazing also. I mean, when these animals are moved out there, I mean, is there any oversight, or are these people just pretty much given carte blanche in what they could do with these cattle? Because just from what I've seen moving through the state, it doesn't seem that some of the policies we've seen on some of these trips are the ones that are implemented out in the field. You see, it seems like you see an awful lot of cases where these cattle have been left out there for a much longer time than they should have been, grazed to much lower levels than you would think would be necessary. Is there really any oversight of this grazing when it takes place, or is this just pretty much a uncontrolled, every man for himself, I feel?
Do you have an opinion?
I do have an opinion. For the record, Bob Welsh, Habitat Program Manager for Section Wildlife DNR. A couple of things sounds like we're talking about here. One is the emergency haying / grazing that occurred here this last summer. We didn't graze in any of those sites. That was strictly haying. And the reason we did that is because we didn't have any grazing plans in place and weren't able to get any in place that quickly to be able to do any grazing. So and so that goes to the question about how we're grazing and whether there's any oversight. And there's a lot of oversight. We're being extremely careful moving forward in how we're implementing grazing, because we know that there's a lot of these concerns and that there's a lot of eyes on the landscape out there and what the cattle are doing. So we are taking a very deliberate approach in developing site-specific plans where we identify the objectives that we want to accomplish on the site and then develop a prescription for that, number of animal days or and whether we're going to do that through a few animals for a longer period of time or a lot of animals for a short period of time to get the hoof action or whatever it is that the manager is trying to accomplish. So there's a lot of oversight. We're not simply opening a site to a grazing cooperator and say, graze it, please.
So what would you think if we were to put a requirement into our language that any grazing would require a plan a year in advance? So that it didn't really open to emergency, but it was part of the conservation plan, but still allowed the grazing where it made sense. I think our gut is that there's a bit of distrust, perhaps,
that our intent is not being completely followed in terms of the recommendations we're making being focused specifically on habitat and what's good for wildlife versus what's good for the local economy in terms of grazing. There isn't one of us that wouldn't be sympathetic to what ranchers would go through, but don't see our role as having to support that in some way. You know, our role is to ensure habitat's there, and it seems like if there's a long-term plan in place, maybe that's a way of addressing the emergency side of it and keep emergencies from being constant.
The timing, first of all, you know, requiring us to have a grazing plan in place, that's in our grazing operating plan. So I see that as piggybacking on exactly what we're doing as management. The timing factor, you know, having a grazing plan in place a year in advance, you know, that's going to be one of those situations that Mr. Becker described, where then, you know, it creates a tracking obligation, if you will, where, okay, we've got to be aware that on certain parcels, that plan needs to be in place a year in advance, versus, you know, maybe we develop a plan over the course of a year, and that's why I think a lot of these site-specific plans, they do take a considerable amount of time, because we, you know, we develop them at the area level, and then they're reviewed by multiple folks, and then they're eventually approved at the regional level. So that can take a considerable amount of time. Whether that's a full year, you know, in some cases it might be, and it might not be. Does that answer your question?
Kind of. I mean, if you're us saying we have this perception that all things aren't right, maybe our perception is wrong, but there is a perception that emergency grazing is used as an excuse to destroy habitat, at least on a yearly, on that particular parcel for the year. What's the safeguard that you think we ought to be asking for to ensure that where we're recommending funds for acquisition of property, that it not be then turned around and used for other purposes?
Well, I think the I'm sorry, I'm not used to addressing properly here, Chair Hartwell, members of the council. I think that the safeguards are the definitions of the unit and how they're managed. I'm happy to have, you know, additional conversations with, you know, with the council or individual council members, if you will, on how we implement a lot of this stuff. But if there is, you know, genuine concern, and I see that there is, you know, I guess I'm approaching this from the standpoint of I know how we manage these lands, and I'm comfortable and confident in what our managers are doing out there. If the council is not, you know, perhaps the way to address it would be on the unit definition side.
Did you have something?
Yes, I did. Thank you. You had mentioned hay was part of the process too, and then we talked about hay being sold. On the land that we have, are you aware of what that hay was used for? Was it used for the farmers for their own cattle, or was it sold? Do you keep track of that?
Councilperson Wilkins, Chair Hartwell, members of the committee. We stipulated in the agreement, in the cooperative farming agreement with the individuals that took the hay, that it be for personal use only. Now, did we follow those bales and make sure and see if any of them ended up being sold? We didn't do that. We don't have the manpower to do that.
However, you know, if we heard from somebody that said, you know, Farmer Jones sold some bales, I think, you know, we would certainly look into it.
Any other? Ron?
Mr. Chairman, I think it's kind of immaterial who bought this land or whatever. I think we're talking about a concern we have for any wildlife management habitat work being done involving grazing, hay, emergency. I could even add control of toxic weeds, as we call them, or whatever, that sometimes raises havoc. My days with South Dakota, one time the land manager was before the commission justifying the fact that he took a wildlife management area and basically mowed the whole thing in the name of weed control, and then said that that also protected the pheasants from being caught by the fox. I go, wow, this is very interesting. Anyway, he doesn't have a job anymore. But so I think our argument here, or concern, is really goes beyond the council here. It's just mostly what our DNR is, their how they treat the haying, grazing, those kind of issues. And apparently you folks understand the importance of it. I don't think we wanted to get into, Bill said, our land has to be done this way, your land can be done any way you want to, that kind of thing.
Mr. Chairman, I guess what I thought I gathered in our visits was that that the grazing in most cases was kind of prescriptive, that it was going to help and not destroy the habitat. Did I get the wrong impression when I was out there?
I think the impression is correct. The question is the practice. That's my, you know, if someone's baling hay, that's not what we were hearing on our trip. Was prescriptive grazing to help habitat, for example. Do you have a comment?
Not sure if I'm if I'm hearing the question correctly. I'll back up a little bit. The question that was brought to the Section of Wildlife is are there opportunities, and our chief put out to our area wildlife managers, is are there opportunities out there where we could accomplish some conservation objectives through either haying or grazing and at the same time provide a forage harvest opportunity. We chose to not implement any grazing because we didn't have any plans in place to develop exactly what you described, prescription to achieve certain accomplishments. We weren't able to do that quickly enough. So we had our managers focus on hay, where taking biomass off the land could help them. And some of the suggestions were maybe on a parcel where you had a prescribed burn plan and description never went right. We weren't able to accomplish it. So a secondary approach may be haying it this year. There were a number of sites where our managers maintain fire breaks around units, and generally they maintain those either by mowing or by disking. So one of our managers thought, well, here's an opportunity to have somebody come and hay and fire break, and that that accomplishes some forage harvest, and it also keeps us from spending money on our fleet and personnel to go out there and mow it. Other places where maybe there's some woody encroachment, and by haying it would set the woody shrubby material back. Those were the main practices that were put in place. And in addition to that, then what we see sometimes is that in an emergency situation, that might actually provide us an opportunity to get that work done where it might not otherwise get done because of the low quality or, you know, a single swath around the perimeter of the unit. In normal circumstances, it might be challenging to find a cooperator that's willing to meet our invasive species requirements and clean his equipment to go on the property and make one lap around to manage our fire breaks for us. So in extreme situations, it can actually provide an opportunity for us.
Thank you.
Danny?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just would want to make a few comments. I think both DNR and U.S. Fish and Wildlife should consider the alternative of doing more burning and what the costs are. We talk about capacity, and maybe we need to build up the capacity because there's a lot of frustration out there, especially. And the other thing is I think the DNR and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife should develop a more flexible plan. Like last summer, the specific instance I was aware of, it was in Big Stone County, which is a U.S. Fish and Wildlife site. They were going to graze it for 60 days, beginning around the 4th of July, on a four-part rotation, 15 days on site. Well, unfortunately, the reality, it never rained over those 2 months. So today, there's really no habitat there at all. And if you happen to be a sportsman, you talk to the two young producers, and they told you their story about, well, we used to graze over on so-and-so's land, and the bulldozers in moved the rocks away, and that prairie is now a cornfield. They begin to think, well, this is clearly a plan to help farmers, not a plan for what it is. So I think our agencies need to be flexible to make sure that the 60 days, if that's what the maximum is honored. And if we're not getting regeneration from additional rainfall, we probably need to shorten up those time spans because it is either a waterfall production area in this case or a wildlife management area. We need to recognize that's what they are. And I think it'll be good if we develop guidelines because I think we have to push the agency and they have to remind the producers because this can be a good tool. But if it gets misused, there's going to be a revolt from the sports community, and then we're going to lose this tool. And so I think we might be trying too hard. Thank you.
So I want to keep this on schedule, but would it make sense for staff to work with the agencies and come back with a proposed strategy that we would include in our recommendations? Everyone comfortable with that? That's what we asked our staff to do.
We will do that.
Thank you. Thank you for helping us understand a little bit more.
Thank you.
So the next, that's the end of the executive director's report. The next item on the agenda is item number 5, which is a memo from me to you regarding a contribution for the legacy website maintenance. There's an agenda item that explains what we're doing here. And then there is a memorandum that gives more detail as to why $15,000 and why now. And to make a long story short, over the biennium for these costs for this legacy website are shared by the legacy funds that are described on the site. That includes not only the Outdoor Heritage Fund, the Clean Water Fund, Parks and Trails Fund, the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund are the legacy sites that are involved. All of the other funds made a biennial contribution. Because of the quirk that we only had an annual contribution last session, we only contributed half of what we owed. We contributed $15,000 out of FY14. we're letting you know that we're going to, unless otherwise directed, write into the council's recommendations the second part of the 15,000, or second 15,000 for FY15. We didn't want that to show up in the bill when people ask, where did it come from, that sort of thing. We are doing it this way because we think we owe it. We think we've agreed to it in the first go-round. So I would, any advice on this would be appreciated.
Not our business, but why does it change in the parks and trails piece?
Because they don't get as much money out of the tax.
But I mean, why isn't it a set rate based on the tax?
You're paying $7,000 for 1 year and $6,000
the next. I don't know why they put it that way. Perhaps Mr. Ubinger can explain.
Again, I'm just curious. Not my business.
We should know.
Morning, Greg.
Good morning, Mr. Chair members. I'm Greg Ubinger with the Website Coordinating Commission. Our office has the responsibility to maintain and support the website. The statute that provides for the website requires that all of the funds contributed on a per rate basis based on the amount of funding that we received from the Legacy Amendment and the Environmental Natural Resources Trust Fund. And it was an odd amount for the Parks and Trails, so we did $6,100 and $7,000 the second.
Pretty obvious.
Thank you.
Other questions?
I guess my question just generically is, you know, most of what I see on the website is sort of a skin on each individual fund's website. You know, we have our own website with a lot of information, and then there's this broader website. It seems like a lot of money to put a skin and list some projects. I mean, I get the startup costs, but the annual costs of maintaining it and dropping in new project information seems like a lot. Can you tell me why I shouldn't feel that way?
Mr. Chair and members, we have presented three funding scenarios to the Environmental Finance Committee chairs for the website. And one was a basic maintenance that I think was at around $20,000 to $30,000. The other two scenarios included improving the mapping capabilities of the site so that citizens could more easily find projects that are near to an area of interest to them. The $100,000 that we've got provided here is the ballpark that we provided to the Finance Committee chairs. We've since published a request for proposals and are evaluating those contracts now. We're guessing it'll come in at somewhat less than $100,000. But it's largely to improve the capability of the site that requires the larger funds.
So we'll see something better than what's currently visible if you, assuming everything goes forward.
Mr. Chair, we hope so too.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you. So, staff's intention is to put this in, you'll see it in the financial form. You have in your packet a schedule, a proposed schedule for 2014. The two things I point out to you, it follows sort of the same general strategy in terms of meetings and timing and such. We've moved the field trip to the fall because the spring is a busy time for staff with all the proposals that come in. Instead of having, as we did this year, 2 weeks of 2 days each on the schedule for hearings, we've put in a block of 3 days in 1 week. Of course, if we don't need to use all those days, we wouldn't use all those days, but we felt like Trying to do it all in one block instead of breaking it up in two might make a little more sense. So I'm open to any questions, suggestions. If there aren't any, we will just adopt this schedule. We have been very careful to make sure we don't get into any holiday situations. So, Rick?
My only comment would be on the last one, December 10th, and it's just often there are a lot of meetings that are state associations, counties, soil and watershed districts. And I know that particular this year, the first week of December and my second, third, kind of odd time. And those of us in the legislature often have to be absent of those. So even looking ahead at the 10th, that's on a Wednesday, I would just say maybe the 11th might be a little better, so you're not getting an overlap of those first 2 weeks. There's just a lot of meetings where people are trying to get stuff done, just like we want.
Welcome to my life.
Before the holidays, so that would be my only comment. Moving on to Brady.
Like Sandy's advice, she's shaking her head saying the 11th is doable. So I would suggest that we just right here amend the schedule as presented to have December 11th in lieu of December 10th.
Anyone object to that?
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't really object except for saying that if you're out of state and come to town, you just soon fill up your days. So this is the 1 of December, not a full day meeting, is it?
Typically, it's not.
Yeah, well, so I don't necessarily disagree, right? but to the point Rick makes, I agree with his point, and that's why I just soon have it when it is. But that's, it's not a serious objection. If everybody else wants it on the 11th, that's fine.
What's the desire? 11th, okay? I want you to know, Rick, I already have another meeting that day that I'm going to be in trouble with. I'll spend. So we'll adopt the schedule as presented, moving the 10th to the 11th. Next is at number 7, which is to review the AIS accomplishment plan. As you'll remember, we had a lot of discussion about AIS, both in the hearings as well as after that, and adopted a recommendation of $3.6 million for a modified proposal that the chair and staff put together based on the concerns that were discussed. We have been working with the Initiative Foundation to come up with an accomplishment plan, which is in your packet. Don Hickman from the Initiative Fund is here to talk about that and answer any of your questions. So, Don?
Good morning.
I'm not sure I've ever seen you in
high. It's not my natural habitat.
So if you can just give us some background on the Initiative Foundation and then the process you've gone through to come up with this draft accomplishment plan and any comments you have about that, that would be great. And we'll open it up to questions.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Don Hickman. I'm the Vice President of Community and Economic Development at the Initiative Foundation in Little Falls, Minnesota. The Initiative Foundation is one of six regional community foundations serving all of greater Minnesota. We were collectively established in 1986 by the McKnight Foundation to foster sustainable economic and community development. In 2013, each of the six of us have net assets exceeding $50 million. We make grants to eligible applicants, and we lend money as a charitable activity to foster economic development. For the last 15 years, I've been working with the foundation to support citizen-led lake and river protection projects. My background's in water chemistry, biology, statistics, and ecology. I attended the University of Minnesota, Western Colorado State College, and Utah State University. We've served over 300 lake associations through this program. We've registered over $1 million in grants to support citizen-led efforts. And I was thrilled when I was contacted by Chairman Hartwell and asked if we'd be willing to participate in advance in the interest of the council to prevent AIS infestations. My understanding is that you have received multiple applications this session, that you are not comfortable with the strategies or scale of any of them. And so the scope of work we were responding to is to look intensively at what are the most effective strategies, the best return on investment of state dollars to engage communities throughout the state that meet those criteria. And as our initial approach to the assignment, we reviewed most of the applications you considered this past term, including those from the Minnehaha Creek Watershed District, the Minnesota Coalition Lake Association, and from DNR. We have corresponded or conversed with all three of those groups and did our best to balance the insights and inspirations of each to do a very focused and intensive program that will identify pilot partners, invest heavily, and include, as best as we're able, which strategies, which investments would give the best return on dollars.
So you've all seen the proposal. Do you want to just outline briefly sort of the major components and steps you go through, and then we'll open it up to questions?
Certainly. In many respects, our original thought was to convene a large group of wise people, key stakeholders. And one of my early lessons as we did this homework was that DNR does have an existing AIS advisory board and is open to working together so that we can maximize the wisdom, the experience, what doesn't work in their previous efforts. Obviously, we want to hit the ground running as quickly as possible. This is an urgent situation. But in our dreams, we would issue a request for proposals as quickly as possible once the money is available. Entities, eligible entities, would respond with first an inquiry explaining who they are, what scale they plan to work, and what their core strategy is. Whoever our advisory council is would invite the strongest ones to submit a full proposal, and that full proposal would represent a prevention plan. DNR had some very constructive input to me. They said there's been all kinds of strategies that have been tried throughout the state, that what they most want to see is very intensive, comprehensive AIS strategies, not piecemeal. It's a balance that constructive criticism. Both Minnehaha and the Minnehaha group pointed out to us that there are limits to how much cash and leverage any local entity can provide. And so we've not locked down as to how many partners we'll work with. We want to see the merit. We want to have the council tell us which ones have the strongest ability to succeed and frankly, to be financially sustainable over time, since I'm equally clear that your goal is not to permanently fund all efforts, but to instead identify the ones that are most effective. And so those are the criteria. We really do want to move as quickly as possible. I've informally explored if one could informally talk to the advisory council prior to July 1st, recognize we can't incur costs just so we can hit the ground running. Our goal would be to get money out to the entities, presuming they are local units of government, watershed districts, et cetera, before the end of 2015, so that they can begin activity over that winter and before spring arrives.
If there are ways to expedite that, we will.
So, question? Elizabeth?
Thank you. In looking at the budget,
yes.
It looks like, and I have two questions on this, so bear with me. Anticipated leverage, you have really an equal amount what this grant process would be in leverage, and it's all listed private source. First question is that assured? Is that definite?
Absolutely not. And it's open to the direction of the council. Our goal would be to seek dollar-for-dollar match from the program partners.
Okay. From the local entity.
Correct.
Okay. And then the other one is, well, there's personnel costs, and we would assume there would be some. But supplies and materials, if everything is being contracted out, where does the $200,000 come from for supplies and materials?
Again, quite frankly, I'm open to influence of the council. My thought was we wanted to keep money in reserve to share the lessons learned and also to promote the program so that any entity that has interest in this opportunity would be aware of it and would have the opportunity to apply. Again, my understanding is at the end of this award, one of the outcomes that we are offering to you is that not only you, but many citizens throughout the state are aware of which strategies are most effective. And so, frankly, much of that would be media or printed material, video, whatever it takes to get the message out to the populace. If we can do it for less, or if that's not a priority of the council, we can certainly make that item. We're not imagining many material costs other than media.
Jim?
Thanks, David. Just from this agenda item 7, this document we have here today, it's very difficult to understand exactly what you're going to do. You're not really very descriptive as to really the actions that you're going to take. But from what I can see here, I don't see how any of these are constitutional uses of the money. How are these issue a request for proposals from potential program partners seeking inquiry level of explanation of their strategies and or potential implementation partners. How does that restore, protect, and enhance? I can't see anything here that looks like a constitutional use of the money. So are you aware of what restrictions we're under here to spend this money?
I am, and I would not pretend to be the expert on the constitutional conversation, but I'm sure all of you are. We have engaged staff at DNR for their directions. I know this has been a conversation there as well. If you have guidance as to how we can keep this within the letter and spirit of the law, I welcome it. I was just responding to the request that we address this thing.
Okay, just somewhere along the line, are we going to get a more descriptive document that actually tells us exactly what you're going to do? This is very, very vague.
It is. And I hope that you don't take this answer in any way flippantly, but in my mind, this is almost an idea or strategy contest, and I don't know what the best strategy or idea, especially comprehensive strategy, will be yet. If we knew the answer to that, you'd already be investing in it to the degree you're able. And so we do want to be open-minded about who the partners will be and what their strategies are. I think that the general categories of strategies are well known. It's education and outreach, it's decontamination, it's inspection on site. There are a long laundry list of strategies people may embrace, but what we're looking for here is what's the right mix, what's the right recipe, even variation in that recipe to be complete across the state.
So when do you think you'll know that? Have that information?
So let's say we were able to issue that RFP within short period of time after July 1st, I would want to give partners enough time to prepare a good level inquiry. I think that gave us a very strong sense of what activities we're being asked to support. And to the degree you want updates, I'll be here upon request any time. Or for that matter, we can provide a summary of the inquiries we received, categorized by strategy, by allocation of budget. But it would be the wise counsel, if this work plan is endorsed, it would be the wise counsel that chooses which ones hold the greatest promise.
Okay.
This sounds like you're doing our job, and it sounds like that's what we should be doing with applications that come to the council.
And I would think this is falls into the category of something similar to the Conservation Partners Program, where instead of us looking at a whole series of small projects, the Initiative Foundation would be doing that work to try to ferret out the best opportunities.
I follow you. I also share Jim's concern. I feel that it's I don't think we're ready to do that. I don't think there are projects that meet the constitutional amendment. That's why we haven't provided funding to date. And we're still waiting for projects that meet our marching orders. So, you know, just to allay anybody in the audiences or in the general population's thought that we're not concerned about AIS, that's cuckoo. We are. But our structure does not provide for this sort of activity. We're looking for on-the-ground work that meets our criteria. And so far, I don't see it.
Danny?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the commission, you know, when we got these AIS proposals, we looked at a couple different ones and thought that maybe some kind of a hybrid could work between them. And if I remember right, either three or four of us, this is probably the only project that had at least three and maybe even four of us want money spent on it, including myself. This is a really important project. I think Commission Member Cox brings up a great point that it's absolutely imperative that it be constitutional what we do. I think this is one that's going to potentially maybe evolve isn't the right word, but it needs to evolve. We also have to recognize that when this money gets spent, it's got to be spent constitutionally. And I want to say if it gets spent, because this is a really important issue that we move forward. But I think I'm really glad that we scheduled meetings through the legislative session, because this single issue here needs to continue to evolve with the partners, recognizing the DNR commissioner sat in that chair and said, don't do it. He works for the governor. He said, don't do this. It's a waste of money. I'm paraphrasing. Those weren't his exact words, but that's what I heard him say. This commission strongly said, we want to do it. And so I think they're a very important partner that we need to work with. If these proposals are just brick and mortar to build modified boat washes or whatever, that's going to be a very, very, very hard sell. That I couldn't agree more with Commissioner Cox. So I want this to go forward, but I really want this body to be involved, because I would expect Representative Wagenius and Senator Tomasoni to have hearings specifically about this. It's their job in the end, this $4 million or 3.6, and we're going to have involvement along the way, and I think that's important. And it's really, we have to try and find a way if we can on this AIS issue, but this has got to evolve, and I appreciate the members' concerns, because we want to be involved in this, because in the end, we don't know exactly what it's going to look like, and I think we need flexibility.
Bill, did you have a thought?
Ron? I would echo both Mr. Cox and Mr. McNamara's thoughts there. I find this a rather vague proposal, not knowing any kind of outcome. I think it, part of it is reinventing the wheel. We already know some things that you're saying you're going to find out. But one that's really missing here is, for example, aggressive enforcement of existing AIS laws. That's wonderful, but we won't know any. We won't know if increasing those penalties would be a partial solution. And that's something that you can't do. Our legislators have to do. So, again, we could spend all this and not know any more than, frankly, than what we had. I'm being a little vague myself. But yet, this is a very important subject, and I was one of those that threw some money at this, and not just a little. But it seemed maybe we're trying to make this more difficult than it is. We should perhaps look at what some other states have been doing. I was talking to Dick Sternberg the other day, and he said he had trouble finding, for example, decontamination units in Minnesota. In Wisconsin, they have them in key areas, and they're not required, but they're voluntary. But he said they're very, very busy as people who are concerned. And I think raising the penalties for running around with water in your boat would also get a lot of attention. But again, I think our legislature has to look at this to get a little more serious. But I'm just rattling on here, but I would like to see something more specific, goal-oriented, and something that I can understand a bit more than what I'm seeing here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I don't disagree with the vagueness necessarily, but I don't think we're looking for anything. I think we're looking for a process here. I think this money is to develop a process to protect our waters, which is the constitutional reason for doing it, from AIS. I would hope that the next time, that the next AIS, for the most part we're talking here about carbon and zebra mussels, I would hope that the next time that, that another AIS, another new AIS billing comes to the forefront, that not only will we have had some research at the University of Minnesota, but that we will have a process that, that this group can more easily process.
Rick?
Thanks. I think it's important to go back to the meeting we had and think about some of the things that were said, and I'm not sure got incorporated into the plan or are explicit enough. And we had Lake Minnetonka folks and the Cola folks come forward with some strategies. Minnetonka said here they had a containment strategy. They didn't want to have their lake be a source for other places being contaminated. And the Cola folks were coming in and said they've got willing partners to work. And I think we said during that meeting we wanted to work with local partners. And for whatever reason, some of those local partners haven't been able to work as well as they could have with the DNR. I don't want to make any judgments on that, but that we try to incent that local leadership to achieve the outcomes of protecting fish and game habitat and the constitutional requirements. And I think where there's many differences of opinion, whether this should happen, how it should happen, what could happen. But a couple of things I think we need to think about in the background. One is that we can't bond for decontamination units. We can't get a different source of funding because of the lifespan of decontamination. We could bond for purchase of properties next to access in a different fund. But I think we have a precedent here where we've paid for pickups, we've paid for fencing. We just had a long discussion about fencing. We paid for things besides land. that are there to meet the goals. We discussed the fencing over and over and over again. This is almost a similar discussion, except doing a lot different types of steps, different types of equipment. So I think that's one thing I would ask, to go back and look at the issue of the equipment. And again, there's ownership in that after the fund has run out. But if the equipment is there, if we've justified fencing as a way to achieve the goals for protecting land, then we should be able to justify the purchase of equipment to build the fence relating to aquatic species. And I'm talking about fencing in a very broad mechanism. Secondly, the issue has been in front of the legislature for 20 years, and we have slowly been reacting to emergencies. I don't know how many TARP summits we've had, but we keep reacting in a kind of glacial pace. And so one of my concerns is the five-year analysis. When I voted for this and when I suggested money for this, is that we try a variety of approaches now, as soon as possible, that would be constitutional to meet the goal of protecting the fish habitat, and that we see how they work, separate from any changes in the legislature. But whether it's prevention coming in, containment going out, voluntary efforts, trying to find some things where you have local leadership say, have you thought of this? Because sometimes both at the capital and the executive branch or in advisory groups, we get stuck in that this is what our template is. And this is a huge issue. We have thousands of votes. We have thousands of Minnesotans who are very concerned about this. So let's try a few things. I think that's what I said at a couple earlier. Let's try some things as a pilot practice. I am less supportive of processes that don't get to the outcome. I'm more willing to take the risk to buy some stuff and have some people to try some methods. We can evaluate as a legislature in Minnesota, and we could promote it rather than having the money go like that. I'd rather the money spent on decontamination unit than on media campaign to tell you.
Danny, did you go?
No,
I'm good.
As just someone who reads a lot and attends meetings, I'm getting a little frustrated with the right hand and the left hand. When I was on LCCMR, we put a lot of money, and I was greatly supportive of the University of Minnesota's Aquatic Invasives Program and their center. And they are providing the process. They're doing the kinds of research that we're talking about in this proposal. So, and there's been many millions of dollars that are supporting that particular effort. So I find it kind of unusual that we would not be relying heavily on some of the things that they're doing already. And they also have a research and education and outreach component. And what you have here is very much the same kind of thing. They're going through the processes. So I think process is already in place. Looking and researching is already in place with excellent people at the helm. So what I would like to see, and why I supported one project in particular, was because it was an on-the-ground, immediate, we were going to see money going there, and they were going to be monitoring, and they were going to be reporting on their effort. So I saw money being put into really a habitat project. And that's what I still support. But I cannot in good conscience, after the 8+ million and the this and that, going to this process already through the University of Minnesota, I cannot in good conscience support another process. That's just my feeling.
So,
Why not? I'm going to jump on that bandwagon with everybody else. When we were going through the allocation processes, my individual scoring put full funding towards the one lake. What was it?
The
Minnehaha one. Because they had a specific plan with a specific goal and an outcome, and they were going to do something. I don't think thinking about it for another year and a half is going to get us anywhere, and this plan is thinking about it for another year and a half. I would rather see us spend the $3.6 million on somebody's going to do something today and not think about it while they try to get more information that somebody else has already collected.
To be clear, our hope is to front load the grants, the contracts back out to community partners immediately as soon as we can evaluate who has the best quality of Minnehaha, Minnetonka. There's another mention. I assume they all will be applying, and we would love, we'd welcome any relationship with the University of Minnesota, the Research Center. I would suggest that the difference between their work and ours is we are not researching. What we'll be evaluating is the success of local entities to implement the strategies the university may be surfacing as most effective. So this is not research. This is how do we make the research actionable at a local level? And frankly, also, how do they financially sustain that? Because some of the strategies are pretty expensive.
Can't you speed it up then?
I'm told not before July 1st. But beyond that, as quickly as folks can engage, and again, if we can even have the request for proposals due July 2nd, or ready for July 2nd, we'll be as quick as we can.
What's the turnaround?
I want to give groups time to prepare, but if we can even share what the opportunity will be prior to July 1st, they could be due July 2nd.
Well, I guess that's what I want for sure at a minimum. I mean, they've got all this time in the meantime.
Yep.
You don't need any more freaking time.
Yep. I would be very open to that.
So let me try to summarize, I think, the feedback, and then you guys can tell me whether or not I'm accurate. I think this is a great process to go through. We're gone to hear a little bit what the concerns are. I think, Don, you ought to think about specifically addressing the constitutional side and making that clear. I do think that there's an opportunity for some of the feedback on what's gone on, which feels like research, to be out of the matching side of this money versus on the side that we're actually providing. So you might think about that. I think focusing on how you intend to get the money out faster. Maybe it's embedded in here, but it's not clear in here. That would be good. And then making sure that you're clear on the and what this came from was needing a comprehensive approach versus a put a station somewhere and hope people show up, but rather work with the community to try to get a consensus on not just decontamination, but also the how it will be implemented in a broader sense than just do the right thing and show up. And maybe if you can address those specifically, which I think are probably embedded but not completely written, this would be a little better received. Does that make sense?
That does, and to get some secured matching ASAP, not theoretical.
Or a requirement. And it might not be 50%. It might be something less than that. But
the difficulty there is folks will have a hard time securing the match till they know they're a partner. And we won't know they're a partner until the council chooses which ones you want to advance. But people could demonstrate as part of their initial contact with us the mechanism for securing match. And that's absolutely consistent with our thinking.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I think from a practical level, we all have to understand July 1st, this process starts. There is nothing that's really going to happen on the ground until the following spring. So there's going to be time to come up with maps. You know, as much as we'd like to see July 2nd, you know, somebody with a shovel doing something, that's not how this works. We'll work with this or any other project that we do, unfortunately. Are there other comments or feedback that we can give to Don so he can rework this a little and come back to us at our next meeting? Elizabeth?
I have a question. Have you actively been working? We had two proposals here that from which this stemmed.
Yes.
Have you actively been working with the people who have put out those proposals? I mean actively working, like have they been a part of developing this proposal here?
My answer would be yes. This process requires a sole project manager, and that's the role I'm offering. Whether both of the previous submitters are equally pleased with what we've got, perhaps not. They would like to have been funded themselves. They've provided very constructive input to us, and we'll continue to engage them at every opportunity, including on the new assignments you've given them, because they may have insights or strategies to address those concerns as well.
Because I would suggest, since though they did receive a fair amount of interest and votes from the council, that they would be a priority for you to get involved in that conversation, and maybe the next time that you're here, maybe even that we would see those representatives here to give their input to. I don't know if that's out of line, but
I don't think that's what we've asked the initiative fund to do. We've asked them to put together a program working with other people, but where do you draw the line? I mean, you know, do we want 20 people here talking about how they want to cooperate? I think we have to, as we do in other cases where they're cooperative projects, you have to look to someone to do the work. You know, one of the things that's important to recognize is we do a reimbursement of expenses, and the Initiative Foundation is willing to front the money and then get reimbursed. And Minn Kola doesn't have the ability to do that. The Watershed District probably does. But that's a key component to our work, is that reimbursement portion. And one of the reasons that the Initiative Foundation was who I reached out to, because without that, it doesn't work.
Mr. Chair, I would just suggest that we look at Goal 2 and Goal 3 and simplify those as best you can and be more specific with them. And because, you know, if you're gonna try a project where you have contamination units in an area and you're going to monitor their use, I mean, this is the kind of information I want to know. And if you're going to, I don't know how you would increase penalties, but maybe increase concentrated enforcement in an area as part of that, to see if that makes any difference, or that kind of thing. Because I think this is such a long list of goals. None of them look like they'd be accomplished, you know, without. That'd just be more specific.
And again, the difficulty is we need a partner that's willing to do that, and they won't know what mix they are prepared to implement. So we can offer them a specific amount, and they show the match. But
give me an imaginary partner to what you would do, like if you had this money and they had it. More specific.
Okay.
Chair, Elizabeth's information with regard to the university, is there something that we could get from the university between now and the next meeting that might be helpful for us to understand what they have done?
We can certainly ask the university to come and talk about specific on-the-ground things that they know will work. What we don't want to hear is what they're working on that might work, because that isn't going to be helpful. I mean, this has to have something that you can actually apply. Danny?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to that point, Commission Member Anderson, if any members haven't ever visited the university and what Dr. Sorensen is doing there, I'm sure they're open to any of the commission members visiting, and it's very, very enlightening and great to see that it's been a priority of this group and the legislature. So I think if you reached out to him or Ms. Nash, that you could get that arranged.
I'm sure we can arrange a tour if members would like that before or after an afternoon.
That's one entity I did not have time to reach out to, but if they could help us rank some of the strategies or weight them as to most effective, that would expedite our review as well. So that's certainly something I can do in the revised work plan.
Thank you. All right. Thank you, Don.
Thank you,
members, for feedback on this. It will come back to us at our September meeting. Next is number 8, Vermilion River WMA acquisition combination with WMA SNA acquisition and detailed overview.
In your package, you have a memo on agenda item 8. This is a request by the department to combine the Vermilion acquisition with the overall WMA-SNA acquisition program. They cite some benefits in terms of less paperwork and reporting. We have Pat Rivers here to give us background on the Vermilion River acquisition, and stands for questions. In addition, there are other people who have information if they need it.
Please go ahead.
And thank you for allowing me the chance to speak about this acquisition. My name is Pat Rivers. I work for the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, Division of Fish and Wildlife. The Division Director, Ed Boggess, is hopefully going to be joining us here shortly. We were hoping for a 9:35 start, but hopefully
already about to join us
here. As Mr. Becker mentioned, we provided some additional handouts that provide some information about this acquisition. You'll have a number of maps, including a restoration concept map, as well as maps depicting what is going to be open to the public on day one, as well as through time. You have two letters of intent, one dated October of 2012, and also one that's been amended to October of 2013, and also information from the PCA about the permits and the environmental stewardship or lack of violations, if you will, on this site by the Simpstone Corporation. First, I want to touch on the role that the Conservation Fund has in this acquisition. The DNR became aware of the willingness of the landowner to sell this land in January of 2012. We discussed internally for quite a while the merits of acquiring this parcel. And when we learned that the landowner wanted to close by December of 2012, we felt there was a need to have a third-party partner help us with this acquisition. And that's when we contacted the Conservation Fund to see if they'd be willing to help us. In that first letter of intent, dated October 2012, you'll see that the costs that we've agreed to pay are related directly to the acquisition, being such as the purchase price of the land, appraisal fees, recording fees, etc. There was never any agreement by us to pay the Conservation Fund a percentage of the value of the sale price or agreement between the landowner and the Conservation Fund. It's simply to pay them for the work they did on our behalf. Since I last spoke in September, we've learned that the landowner is willing to sell after July 1st of 2014, meaning that funds from the council that they would be provided would be available to us to couple with other funding and kind of not necessitate a interim holding by the Conservation Fund. We view that as a good thing. I think Steve Hobbs also views that as a good thing. Any purchase price for this property would be based on the certified appraisal. We're working to get that. and certainly that would be the basis of our negotiations with the landlord. Steve has been coordinating with myself and also other lands and minerals staff within the DNR, and taking really direction from us, and he's been a great partner. And I just want to be sure that this is a DNR-led acquisition with help from the Conservation Fund. Since our meeting in September, we've decided within the DNR to obtain a second appraisal. This is a pretty complicated acquisition. We felt if we were to get a second appraisal and have that certified or technically reviewed at the same time as the first appraisal, we'd have two appraisals to look at, and we would certify the appraisal that was best for, supported in its value. You'll hear later from Susan Dana about a request to use the high priority pre-transaction costs for the second appraisal, and I'll leave her present that. It's pretty unusual for us to acquire an active gravel operation, but we feel it's a kind of a win-win for everybody involved. As you'll see in that packet, the permits in this for this site date back to 1996 with no record of environmental contamination or problems to the river or other issues of violations. Mining will continue on the site whether the state acquires the land or not, and the company will be held to the conditions of permits by the township and also the Pollution Control Agency. In our agreement to buy the land, as a supplement to the deed, we will outline the conditions for aggregate removal as well as the restoration plan. In your packet, you'll see a restoration map, including a handout that we just provided. One of the benefits of this acquisition is that the Sepsis Corporation has agreed to do more than the bare minimum for reclamation of a mining site. I'll touch more on that in a moment. But you'll see on that on the list, on the back seat, you'll see a numbers of species that would not be present with a basic reclamation. As was noted in my proposal back in June and again in September when I reworked the, or in October when I revised the accomplishment plan, Dakota County and Empire Township have a desire for a trail to run along this river corridor. And we wanted to acknowledge that in the initial proposal so you knew about that potential. If that trail would go through this parcel, we would provide a map of where that would potentially be, as well as fund that corridor with other funding, not with our same subdivision funding. In talking with the county, their amenable, if such a trail would exist on this parcel, that it would be closed during the shotgun deer season, and it would also be open to public hunting at other times of the year. It wouldn't be closed to hunting, I would say, in September. So just a few last comments before I'm sure we get to questions. We do have a willing landowner who's willing to work with us on a significant donation, which makes this a good time to acquire this property. I should say that the appraisal, the numbers we're working with right now are not certified, but assuming that they will be in some close fashion, we do have that donation potential. I noted the restoration benefits. The parcel would have 260 acres open to public hunting or use on day one, so it's not like we need to wait the entire 10 years or so to acquire this land or to have access to it. I mentioned restoration benefits. As we kind of roll through the different 40s and you see those maps, phase 1, 2, and 3, one of the benefits of having Sepsis restore those lands through time is that we can see how they do in that restoration process. If restoration of phase 1 doesn't look like how we want it, we need to modify or adjust. Phase 2 and phase 3 can also be done in such fashion. With that, I want to turn it over to my counterpart for at least an introduction, and then open it up for questions.
Let me just apologize for being ahead of the game. You did show up on time. I want everyone to know that.
Mr. Chair, I think that's a good thing. I apologize for being late. I had another appointment. I just was
you weren't late. Here.
Mr. Chair and council members, I'm Ed Bogus, Director of the Division of Fish and Wildlife, and I don't know what all Mr. Rivers has got through already, but just wanted to be here to help respond to questions or concerns that we're hearing this council members may have about this proposal. We're excited about this proposal. We don't get a lot of high quality acquisition opportunities in the metro area. This is really a good one. It has a hunting opportunity, fishing opportunity on it, and so we're hoping we can work our way through whatever questions or issues or concerns people may have, and keep this moving forward. So with that, I think we'll just see what questions there may be for us. Okay?
Thank you, Jared. Well, the action item in front of us is, first, my understanding, combining this project with the WMA. So that's what we have to consider under a motion. So my question is, what is the effect of that? If we combine this recommendation, which we allocated a certain amount of money to, and we had allocated another amount of money to the overall WMA acquisition, what does that mean? Does this go to the top of the list, and then we recommend the spending of that those dollars first? Does this move other items on the list in terms of prioritization? And are there any other properties on the list that have active mines on them?
Mr. Chair, Council Members, Representative Hansen, the goal of combining the two appropriations was simply to create efficiency not only for the DNR but also for the Council staff in terms of reporting and accounting. If they were to be combined, we would still be going after this acquisition, dedicating $4.25 million of that combined total to this acquisition. We wouldn't be taking any funding from the WMA SMA program or from this program and moving it. It would simply be to combine, make efficiencies, if you will. I suppose you could say if this project were to fail, which I don't think it will, we could add another metro project that would allow us to dedicate that money to a metro WMA acquisition. That isn't the intent. The intent was simply efficiency. And to your final question about gravel, no, there are no other gravel parcels on our WMA SMA list.
Rick? So I'm just thinking of visualizing the bill here, that this would be drafted as of this amount X is appropriated to. So I think we've made a recommendation. Not that I agree with that recommendation, but we've made that recommendation. So as this looks in it, for session law purposes, it would be identifiable within the appropriation.
Based on our current recommendations, the question is, should we agree to combine it with the other project so that it doesn't have the same intent? I think that's the question.
I think you can combine the accomplishment plans, but I think that the way it looks when the legislature votes on it, you would have an appropriation. I'm just going to round here. It says $10 million, of which $4 million is for this particular intent.
That is the intent, with the addition that where the parcel be abandoned, the money set aside for that parcel would be directed to the metropolitan area. Just what I've heard.
I think that's really the consideration of the motion that's some of them make.
There is no motion.
There is no motion now, but then the other issues may.
So maybe we'll ask questions on this particular project and then talk about their request to combine the two. Jane, you had a question, didn't you?
Yes, I did. Thank you. On the restoration path, what percentage of this description is already required by law, and what percentage of it would be over and above what's required by law?
Mr. Chair, Council Members, Council Member Kingston, I think we all have to be reclaimed to some level.
I'm not talking about the question of restoration. It does have to be restored, and there are current laws that have a minimum set of requirements to restore mine property, but how much of it
money-wise, do you view as over and beyond what the law already requires? The seed mix, I mean, how much is that? And how much more are they doing? I'm looking at the map, and it's schematic.
Sure.
You know, short grass prairie, tall grass prairie, a couple of parking lots. And is the trail going to go along the floodplain forest? I just wanted some more detail about all of that. And how much of a gift is the over and above restoration work?
Mr. Chair, Councilmember Kingston, this is not in my wheelhouse. There are other people in the audience that can speak better to it, but I have heard that a high-level restoration, which is kind of what we're aiming for with that species mix, can run $400 per acre of seed. You add that with the time to work the land to the proper
grade,
get the soil back on, and to incorporate the seed, that's a lot of additional person time. I don't know the number for that, and we can work on an estimate on that.
I can tell you that this goes far beyond what you see in terms of normal, let's just get some prairie in the ground.
Yeah, I get that sense, and I'm looking for more specific detail on it.
So, I think you have an assignment.
Yes, we do.
So, another question? Jim?
Pat, I just don't understand this efficiency. If this is going to be a more efficient program, if you combine the two, why didn't you do it originally when you brought it forward to us? And secondly, this particular project looks like it's going to have a lot of issues with it that might drag on for some time. I mean, isn't that going to drag the whole project down?
Mr. Chair, Councilmember Cox, that is an argument for keeping it separate. If the council would choose to keep it separate, that would be perfectly acceptable to us. Initially, when we have these large acquisitions like the Vermilion Complex, they had kind of lost in a larger list of acquisitions, and we felt it was better to pull it out, at least in terms of letting you see what's involved, specifically for the reasons you've indicated. It's a complicated acquisition. We do feel confident moving forward that we can work through the issues. We've come a long way even since September, and we'd be comfortable either way, whether they were combined or kept separate.
And I would just remind the council that if we combine it, it will be in the accomplishment plan, and if the project doesn't go forth, we would see a different accomplishment plan for different parcels. So it's not like we wouldn't have a chance to talk about the alternative. But, and Ryan, you're looking very confused. So we'll go ahead and ask me why I'm confused.
I'm confused because did we not approve both of these projects?
Yeah. I'm talking about if they were combined. And
I know. So if we already approved them separately, why are we losing sleep about combining them? That's my question.
And I was trying to say if they're combined, the accomplishment plan for a combined project would specifically be targeted to this property. And if that fell apart and the DNR wanted to use that money for something else, it has to come back to us for us to approve it. So it's not like they get the money and then they get to do what they want. Denny.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think what you're saying is what I'm supportive of. But I believe the DNR may have looked for the flexibility if this deal fell through to move that $4.2 million within the metro, and I think this body has to review that. We should not give the DNR the authority to move that. It's a huge acquisition. I would agree with your potential motion like that.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I do have a question about the trail whenever it's appropriate.
Good, I have one too.
Mr. Vaugus, clearly, I hope, would be in DNR's thought process that no trail in here is specifically paved or some kind of hard surface trail would be in your best intent. Trail specifically, and you acknowledge that in your accomplishment plan. It says that the county and Empire Township have an interest in a corridor to run, it says within this proposal, and I was going to say that, but you actually already acknowledge it. The county and the county, I don't know if I guess the township has said, I think they're being supportive of the county. would like to see it on the north side of the river. Currently, the trail is on the south side of the river with the agreement. The proposed trail is on the south side of the river west of this area in the vicinity of the Miles property. It would certainly be my hope that we could continue to have that trail on the south side of the river, and DNR should advocate for that, acknowledging we need a trail in this corridor of the Vermilion River to get from west to east. But we should continue to work with the county and the township on that location. I think it's fair to say that we realize the trail is going to be in this area. If it is in this area, similar to Mississippi Northwoods, that could be determined later with approval by this body or review by this body. But then compensation, however that's done by someone other than Lessard Sands, we can't pay for a trail right away. I mean, maybe you could argue that you're going to have capable partners, which I certainly hope we would not negotiate with the county to use capable partners to fish and hunt this area. And so there would be some value, I guess. But DNR needs to be serious in their negotiations with Dakota County. Because if you look on the previous map, and it's hard to identify, but the Butler property is on the previous map. Dakota County got 400 and some acres of that 800 and some acre parcel to bonding money in 05. The DNR was extremely nice to Representative Hansen and my county, which we're both residents of, in how they've done. This is a wildlife management area for habitat, for one of the big selling points. You go back to the original University of Minnesota deal, was this area was about habitat, 3 miles wide, no roads, no paths. And that's what we should be trying to do. This is a wildlife management area. I realize it needs a trail, and I support a trail getting from east to west. But I think it's yet to be determined exactly the alignment of that trail. And so I just want DNR to fight for the original intent, Mr. Chair.
You know, I just follow up with that and say if there's a trail that's going in, I understand why there would be a need for a trail. The money that needs to come forth to pay for that trail has to take into consideration the effect of the fragmentation that that trail would provide, not a 60-foot-wide corridor, so you take a fraction of a percent and say, you know, all is good. You know, a paved trail that you can run pipes and other things up and down, you know, has an effect hundreds of feet out. And I think I'm expecting you to come back with something that specifically says, if there is a trail, this much is what we would find money for from another source that takes into consideration fragmentation. That's my personal feeling. Maybe nobody agrees with that.
I agree.
Rick, did you have a question?
A couple things. So just to clarify, in the absence of a motion, right, this stays as a separate accomplishment plan?
That's right.
I think at the last meeting I asked about what was the effect of the aggregate tax in Dakota County with Semstone, if the state purchases the property, would Semstone still be paying the aggregate tax?
Mr. Chair, Council Members, Representative Hansen, it's my understanding they would be paying the aggregate tax.
But if the state purchases the property, they would no longer be paying the property.
Correct.
And
does the appraisal recognize that and provide for a calculation of the effect of the value of not having to pay property taxes while you control the land?
I believe it does. I can confirm that. I haven't seen the appraisal. But those are conditions that are present on the land, so I believe it does.
And I thought I heard you say that the urgency on this has been flexible, that it's moved from a year ago to last year to this fall to end of this year to now July 1st. So could you maybe describe the urgency of of this, and then if the appropriation became available on July 1st, it would seem to be there'd be no role for the conservation fund for compensation. Is that correct?
Well, let me describe how I see it. The most precious thing we can have in land acquisition is a willing seller. And when we learned about this in January or February of 2012, we had realities put before us that the seller noted. We tried to honor those, and it has been a moving target, and it has evolved, and so has our approach to deal with that. In dealing with the conservation fund, we got them involved early and often because of the desire to sell by December 2012. Steve has carried the ball on our behalf and has developed a relationship with the landowner. We are also in touch with that landowner. So in terms of do we just pass the baton and get the conservation fund out of that, I'm not sure that's the best relationship building we should do to make this deal work. I see going forward that the conservation fund would have a diminished role, but certainly a role along with DNR staff to make this acquisition happen, hopefully in July of 2014. And to be clear, there would be no holding costs with that, so that would be a good thing.
So there would be no holding costs. So there's no compensation. Any work that's being done on this right now is not compensatable because there's no appropriation. And if there's no need for the closing after the first year, the first of fiscal year, then the conservation fund would not have compensatable expenses.
Mr. Chair, Council members, Representative Hanson, in our initial letter of intent, we noted the conservation fund did not acquire it. They would not be reimbursed for their expenses. Now, if conditions have changed and we're going to take the lead, and if we acquire it directly with the help of the conservation fund, it would be my intent to reimburse them for the costs that they had put forward. Not with the Sark Sam's Ultra Heritage funding, but with other funding that we have within the DNR. We've come a long way in part because of the conservation fund, and I feel it would be the right thing to do to compensate them for that time. And I believe that's outlined in the amended letter of intent.
Just to be clear, though, so then the Outdoor Heritage Fund would not be compensating those costs, maybe the Game and Fish Fund or other funds.
Mr. Chair, Council members, Representative Hanson, if you look at our accomplishment plan as proposed October 17, 2013, we have one line item for $4.25 million in fee title. That's the only item in that budget for this acquisition.
Denny, did you have some? Sorry.
Well, it's my understanding from the amendment, or from the memo we have, that if it's successful, the conservation fund would be reimbursed on a fee basis for actual and cost fees per the schedule outlined. And one potential place that would come from would be like RIM match money, I'm assuming. But none of it would come out of this money. This $4.2 million would be 100% used for acquisition of habitat. And conservation fund would only be paid with a successful acquisition that at this point in time would not include a temporary ownership by conservation fund, because Conservation Fund has been able to negotiate them waiting for the transfer until after July 1st, when these funds, if they did become available, could happen. So that the only cost that Conservation Fund would succeed in this acquisition along with DNR would be on per this schedule outline, and it would not come out of this money.
That is correct.
Thank you. The original proposal that we saw had the price paid at a considerable amount more than $4.25 million. And that's the allocation that we are recommending. Is there been talk about where that other monies will come from? It isn't going to come from another grant or the SNA. It isn't going to come from another pot that has a grant coming from this, from Lasart Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council.
Mr. Chair, Council members, Ms. Wilkins, we still don't have a certified appraisal, but the appraisal that we do have, we've been able to negotiate a $900,000 donation. There will be self-matching RIM and additional Reinvest in Minnesota RIM credits in Region 3 that we've made available for this acquisition.
So, we'll follow up. So that you really are have some matching funds here available so to this purpose so that you can get the negotiation done, you have the adequate funds to do it.
Yes, we do.
So, what's before us is a question of whether or not we want to combine the accomplishment plans or leave it as is. The DNR, as we've heard, can live with it either way. No motion is a motion to leave things the way they are, and if someone wants to make a motion to combine them, we can address that. Jenny?
Mr. Chair, you don't make motions as the chair of this body?
No. I'm not going to make a motion.
Well, I would make the motion that they combine them with the intent, as Mr. Mishara said, that what our original intent was, whatever it is, X amount for WMA and Y amount for Vermilion acquisition, and if they fall through, one is a priority, so it won't fall through, but if this deal falls through, they're back to this group in one of our later meetings to reallocate, and we can decide. I mean, where it goes and how it goes, I think that would be appropriate. So if the staff has that, I'll make that motion.
Does staff understand the motion we just made?
We understand the motion to combine the appropriation.
Okay.
The motion is to combine the Vermilion Wildlife Management Area acquisition with the WMA SNA program and to stipulate that, I believe it's $4.2 million, is available for Vermilion Wildlife Management Area acquisition in the event that acquisition fails. The funds are available as approved in the accomplishment plan by the Lasard Sands Outdoor Heritage Council for acquisition in the metropolitan area.
Yes, that's my motion.
And we're recorded.
If you need a second, I'll second that. Okay, but I will say this. I am concerned about that trail. Is there something we can add that would stipulate that this trail will meet certain criteria? I mean, you talk about fragmentation. I'm thinking, how would you like to be out there bedlining with your dog and you got somebody walking along riding a bicycle? I mean, this just doesn't work.
Have a block for you.
Have a block for me. So I'm concerned about the trail interference with the original purpose of this. But my other thought is to my fellow council members, 50 years from now, they're going to be amazed that we even debated this whole project, because this is a gem in the Twin Cities that, if we don't do this, it's going to be gone. It's going to be housing. We all know that. But I'm just saying, this should be a no-brainer.
So, if you'll give the chair a little license.
You have it, sir.
Would instruct DNR to come back with a revised accomplishment plan that specifically outlines, if the trail goes through, the consequences and effects, so that we understand your thinking in terms of how you would handle that and the funding that would be required to specifically deal with the trail issue. And they're nodding and said that's okay. So we will see a revised accomplishment plan with that included one way or the other in December. Was that any other?
I'll just say, I guess I'll be the no-brainer here, but I really think we have to consider this issue of the state purchasing property and allowing the continual aggregate mining to occur. That's a big precedent, and you may not fully come to appreciate that precedent as the years go by.
Are you recommending we do something because of that, or just want people to know that we're setting precedent?
Setting the precedent.
Okay. All in favor of the motion?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The ayes have it. Thank you. Next is item 10. Direct support services authorization.
Roll call. Davis?
Yes?
Davis, item 9.
I'm sorry. Vermilion River WMA proposal on use of high priority transaction services. Thank you. Susan, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Susan Damon with the Department of Natural Resources Division of Lands and Minerals, and I am the project manager for the High Priorities Pre-Transaction Service Acceleration project. This is a project that has $50,000 in funding available for high priority pre-transaction services if authorized by the council. The request that we're making connects with the Vermilion WMA project, and we are requesting the ability to use the funds from the Hyper Priority Pre-Transaction Service project to conduct that second appraisal on the site that Pat Rivers mentioned. The primary driver of the second appraisal would be the need for a gravel evaluation on the, particularly on the portion of the land that would not be mined, where we would actually be acquiring the gravel resource. And the funding would be used to pay for that gravel evaluation, and that would be used as part of the second appraisal to determine the value, because the gravel value itself comprises a large amount of the value of that person.
Okay. Jim?
Was the value of the gravel used in the first appraisal?
Mr. Chair, Councilmember Cox, there was a gravel valuation, but there was not for the Brockman site. There are two parcels. One is essentially one is the Brockman site. Data was received by the Sunstone Company for the gravel on their portion of the land. But there was no actual data received for the Brockman parcel where the DNR would be actually acquiring that gravel resource. It would not be mined.
Why not?
I don't know the answer to that. This was an appraisal that the Conservation Fund requested, so perhaps somebody from the Conservation Fund answer that, or maybe Cat Rivers.
Yeah. So should the DNR have known from the beginning that this was going to need two appraisals? I mean, why are you waiting until now to come to us and use this money and do this mineral evaluation? I mean, shouldn't the DNR have known after what we went through with Northwoods that this had to be done a long time ago?
Mr. Chair, Councilmember Cox, I don't have the answer to that. It's with the very high value parcels, it's very likely that a second appraisal will occur, but it depends on the actual of the first appraisal and whether the DNR believes that the first appraisal is adequate for purposes of establishing the entire value. And we did not know what the content of that appraisal was until it was presented.
Just one quick follow-up. Do you know potentially what the value of this land could be per acre with the gravel?
I do not know.
Does anybody in the DNR know?
Mr. Chair, Council Members, Mr. Cox, you can step back just a minute and help us clarify from my perspective. We could use that first appraisal and request that technical review to go forward, and we very likely would get a number we could live with. If we did that and we were still maybe uncomfortable with only having one appraisal, we would need to go ahead and get a second appraisal, and then those two appraisals would not be comparable because they weren't technically certified at the same time. So we're in a bit of a pickle here in terms of, do we certify the first appraisal or do we start a second appraisal and have them comparable late winter, early spring? The appraisal hasn't been made available to us. It hasn't been through that technical review, so technically it's protected.
So you have no idea potentially what that land could be worth with the minerals on it?
I guess I'm uncomfortable sharing that number here.
This whole thing looks pretty suspicious, to be honest with you, Pat.
Danny?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Commissioner Member Cox, the requirement in statute is that if its appraised value is more than $10 million, it requires a second appraisal. The first appraisal, which isn't certified yet, which generally then they're not even public, and so it's hard to talk about something, but allegedly, allege is not the right word, the word is kind of out that the appraisal potentially, when you put the value of minerals on it, which we're not buying because they're going to be mined by the existing owner, I don't think it reaches $10 million, but when you add the minerals together, which are on the property, it does exceed $10 million, I think, potentially. So to be prudent and to be sure we're covering the law, and we're spending $4 million potentially of state money, it probably makes a lot of sense to spend up to $50,000 for additional second appraisal, which I think many in the legislature would say is required. And based on our past experience, we're going to have to spend a lot of money on second appraisals to make up $3 million that we saved in Mississippi Northwoods of this council's recommended spending. So I think the second appraisal probably makes sense. And these things are really tough to deal with, and I don't know all the legalities of it, but they're protected when they're not yet certified. And there's a timing, as Mr. Rivers mentioned, about between the two that needs to take place. So I think it's warranted the second appraisal. In regards to what the land's worth, I mean, we can kind of figure out if we're paying, you know, we're paying 4.2, the owners donate 900, and then there's also, you talked about the need for some rim match. So you kind of add up 4 and 1, and another one is about 6. And then there's minerals on top of that, and they're going to mine for the next 10 years. I'd imagine they're mining millions of dollars worth of gravel, but we'll know more when a second appraisal, when they're certified. So I think that kind of helps.
So the question in front of us is whether or not we want to authorize the use of the $50,000 or a portion thereof to do a second appraisal that we have put into previous is available to us because we allocated it previously to be used specifically for these purposes. Staff would like our recommendation to do that before they just say this is fine. I would point out if we do that, we now don't have the money available for any future projects that come up. And so we need to think about that in terms of should we put more money on the table in our recommendations this year so that we would have the ability to do this going forward. And they're two completely separate issues. One is whether we should allow the use of our existing funds, and then there's the question of what do we do going forward. But is the sense of the council that we ought to allow the use of the funds that have been set aside for pre-acquisition appraisals for this project? Is there a motion to allow that, perhaps, get it on the record? Ron?
I'll make that motion.
Any discussion? Everyone clear? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Opposed.
No.
Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, could along the line that you just mentioned, could staff come back at our next meeting with the thoughts about a recommendation that potentially our recommended funding bill for next year look at the idea of replacing this money if it's spent? I think your point, that was the idea, we wanted to kind of be ready and allow things to happen proactively. Maybe they can come back and see if things have changed somewhere. Maybe some money is available.
We really have
our next meeting.
I mean, we can vote today to add that to our recommendations and go, you know, we set aside 5% based on projections as a balance. We could eke into the 5% by recommending a $50,000 addition to our current recommendations to replace that money, knowing that we'd be 4.9-something%, or we can wait for the forecast and see if there's any extra money, which would then we could talk about allocating that and keeping it to 5%, or we could do nothing. Jane?
I'd like to wait to see how everything comes out in the final budget.
Okay. Anyone feel any differently? Denny, I'll make sure that staff considers the issue and brings back some recommendation in December. All right. Great. Thank you very much. Next, item 10 is direct support services authorization, but Dave Shedd is not here, so we will flip the order and move to number 11, review and progress draft of conference plan. I'll just preface this before turning it over to staff. We got a book of accomplishment plans. Our bill that we will recommend to the legislature on January 15th is based on the accomplishment plan, is based on our recommendations and the accomplishment plans that are in this package. So we rarely gave full funding, so people had to cut back in some ways and then put that together in a revised plan. That's what we're looking at today. To be clear, we are not approving the accomplishment plans today. That's something we do in the spring after the bill is actually approved, because we don't want to approve an accomplishment plan and then have to reapprove accomplishment plans if anything changes in the legislature. So this is a chance for members to ask any questions about revised accomplishment plans that would affect how anything is presented here or presented in our bill to the legislature. We will have another swipe at this once the final bill is approved. Is that clear to everybody what we're doing? This is your chance to ask any questions on any of the revised accomplishment plans based on the funding that we recommended at our last meeting. So, Bill, with that, I'll turn it over to you.
In your packet is an action item memo, agenda item memo, for agenda item 11. And go through this very briefly. What we're looking at a very high level, progressing these accomplishment plans, moving them to the next stage. And the things that are critical that we have to have for the bill, we have to have the recipients properly identified, the cooperators properly identified, the roles of the cooperators and the understanding that they provide, the amount of the appropriation, the purpose of the appropriation, and any specific direction or conditions that the council feels should accompany the appropriation program. We'll revisit this after this is drafted in the bill form. So you're telling us today what to put in the bill. We'll put it in the bill, get it out to you before the December meeting, and it'll be finally reviewed and approved, amended at that meeting. So we're taking a stepwise approach to this, so new steps in time. With that, I would like to have Ms. Coop provide any comments that she might have about the accomplishment plan.
Thank you, Bill. Members of the council, I just wanted to make sure that everybody understood that there were a couple of changes in the draft accomplishment plans that you received. One in your packet related to the DNR accelerated shallow
Lake Restoration Enhancement Program. There was a miscalculation, or actually not a calculation, but the direct support services was not included originally. It was put into another line item that was switched back to accurately reflect that budget. There was a change in the budget for professional services for the Cisco Lakes project, which is like Area Watershed Foundation and then Cisco Land Trust, and you received an update on that as well. In addition to the Vermilion River WMA accomplishment plan that was presented today, as well as the HAIS for the Aquatic Invasive Species proposal. There were two items, two motions that were made at the last meeting for which staff requested clarification. One related to native prairie acquisitions and the other related to inland grazing. So if staff could receive clarification on those two issues as they relate to appropriations, that would be most helpful.
And with that, I would open up for discussion or questions that anyone had in reviewing the draft development plans in your book. Rick?
I'd like to talk about the Sharptown grounds.
And can you identify which one that is so those of us...
FA04.
Easily subject. Okay, thank you.
I don't know if there's a project manager here. Summer, we went back on a previous Sharptown grouse one and we changed the accomplishment plan to respond to changes in what was available or what properties were or were not available. And so I just like clarification on the properties that are in this accomplishment plan. Are the appraisals found? Are there, if these properties are not available, are you going to be presented with another list of properties after the appropriation has occurred? Or I'd just like some clarification so we don't go through it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. For the record, my name is Joe Pavelko, the Director of Conservation for Pheasants Forever. And we're partnering with the Sharptown Grouse Society on the project. We have not to date done any appraisal work on any of these properties. But from our previous discussions on the Dunn Lake WMA in Aiken County, that was kind of an outlier because of the circumstances around the wetland mitigation and just the uniqueness of that property is why we had to come back. But with these properties that are on the list now, we don't see any outliers where we would have to come back and say, oh, you know, this is going to be worth a lot more than what we thought. These are all pretty standard run-of-the-mill projects that there shouldn't be any issues.
Just to clarify then, so the properties that are you're anticipating here are not ones where there could be wetland restoration for mitigation within the greater than 80% counties or any mining activities that may have loss.
Mr. Chair, members, as of right now, we're not aware of any of those. And, you know, that those are pretty well-known areas, I guess. And, you know, we check to make sure that we're not going to have another project like that. We don't see any potential weather mitigation. I mean, you always have potential for any kind of mitigation if there's drinking wildlife. But
to the large scale like that, we don't see anything.
Mr. Chair, I think the state paid Bowser, and Bowser did a study looking at potential sites for mitigation. Just to clarify, these properties are not on any bug list.
I have not, Mr. Chair members, I have not checked that list, so I can't say one way or the other.
Mr. Chair, be helpful. I don't want to go through every acquisition that we have, but maybe before the next meeting, if there's any other project proposers that are dealing with lands that would be protected through mitigation, particularly in the greater than 80% counties in the Northeast, I think it's helpful to know that so we don't have to come back after the fact and have to account for that appraisal. I don't want to do anything right now, but I think we just have to be careful when we're doing some of these acquisitions, that particularly where there's very little mitigation opportunity, that will drive up the price, and we still may achieve a goal without a public investment.
So what are you asking that we...
My questions are answered on this property.
Okay.
If there are other project proposers that have something that is a mitigation property, that they just notify us before the...
Mr. Chair, we'll poll the acquisition manager.
I just wanted to get clear what it was you were actually...
Including this one.
Yes. Mr. Chair, what is the basis for the valuation you place on the parcels in the list you provide?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Beck, can you clarify?
Are you using assessor's values from the... Are you using local experts? Are you using the university's land sales records that are available on the computer? What is the...
Mr. Chair and members and Mr. Becker, it's a great question. And we use, I guess, a combination of the assessed value and our past experience acquiring property in that area, and you know, knowing you know, what the property's highest and best use would possibly be. And a lot of these, it's pasture ground. So you're not going to be paying corn land prices for pasture ground. So that's... It's mostly just past experience and checking with the assessed value to make sure there's nothing too off about the properties.
Thank you. Any other questions on this one? Okay, thank you. Other questions in reading the accomplishment plans that anyone has for any of the projects? Bob?
Mr. Chairman, FA02. And I'm specifically referring to page 4 under the hunting and fishing plan, whereby there'll be a shared DNR tribal system of regulations on this land when it's purchased. My question would be, what guarantee does the state of Minnesota have that that shared system will continue into perpetuity?
Do we have someone here with this project?
Yeah.
Greg, can you, I'm looking to you, hoping that you have an answer to this. The agreement that gets signed by the applicant and the state when the money flows through, how does that affect something like this in terms of their being bound to follow through on the intent of the proposal?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, what it,
My understanding is that there's a contract that will be signed by the band with the Department of Natural Resources to get the money. And in that contract, you can specify what needs to happen. There are some issues here. Under our current law, it says that hunting and fishing will be open as prescribed by the commissioner for lands that are not state land, not owned by the state, or U.S. Fish and Wildlife. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife have a special provision for that. Now, the ban, though, isn't necessarily subject to state law on this issue, but they would be subject to the contract terms. What you have in here, it talks about the hunting and fishing plan, and you've got the seasons and limits that are just given website. The question is some place in the contract, whether it's the attachment of the encapsulation plan with the hunting and fishing plan included, it needs to be clear that the contract specifies that continue as it is in the plan and not be changed. The other issue that could arise is where there are disagreements between the DNR and the band, where those are resolved, because that's not always clear when you're dealing with American Indian bands. It could be a tribal court or a state court system, and since this is state money, I mean, you may want to specify that it would be resolved in state court and not in tribal court, because this is state money that's going into it. That may be something to think about as part of the accomplishment plan and as part of the contract. But again, I would recommend that be very clear in either the contract or the accomplishment. My understanding is being attached to the accomplishment plan, it becomes part of the contract. So it's in the accomplishment plan, it would then become part of the contract. But at some point, I think you need to have that contractual obligation and those responsibilities laid out before the contract is signed.
So would it make sense for our next meeting to have the DNR address that issue as to what's going to be in the contract specifically, so that this is clear? Heather, I see you have some thought.
We do our contract advisor in the audience.
Oh,
question here.
Great. She will come down. There you are. Morning.
Amanda Graver. I'm the grants manager in OMBS at
DNR. Okay. If you can help us understand what you guys will put in your contract to ensure the openness of hunting and fishing on this property, that would be most helpful.
What was just described is exactly what happens. The accomplishment plan is an attachment to the contract, so anything that's in that accomplishment plan becomes a part of the contract.
With the exception of how it would be enforced if there were a disagreement?
What are the enforcement provisions in the contract, I guess is the question.
Can you clarify that for me a little bit? I'm sorry.
If this or anything else were to not go the way you expected and we expected, how does it get enforced? Is it state law, state court? Is it specified?
I can't think of any particular examples of that, but so I can't say for sure.
Bill?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Graver, is the venue specified for disputes to be Ramsey County?
It is.
Okay. So it's a Ramsey County court that it gets heard in.
Let me ask one other question. I wanted to ask this for a long time. 97A.056 subdivision 15.
You stop that.
Deals with ensuring that the property bought with the Outdoor Heritage Fund remains dedicated and used as intended upon the appropriation of the dollars in purchase of the land. It provides a requirement that a deed restriction be entered upon the deed of the property filed, in the local venue. It prescribes a manner in which conversions would be addressed by the legislature. Is that section of statute either directly referenced or copied into the contract?
Mr. Chair and members, I don't believe that that particular language is a part of the contract, but it is referenced that section.
I believe it is to the advantage of the state in all contracts dealing with outdoor heritage fund, especially acquisition, to explicitly lay that out. It is unique. It's not something you would normally run across. And I think an eyes wide open approach in dealing with management of land, ownership of land, is going to serve us well if we ever get into a dispute. So I was recommending we
just a point of clarification that the full text is not in the contract itself, just the section is referenced, but it is an attachment to the contract, the full text of that section.
That helps the lawyers.
So, as a lawyer.
Is that language included in the deed? The deed that's actually filed with the county recorder's office when the property is transferred.
Mr. Chair members, I'm sorry.
Okay. If it isn't, it should be.
Okay.
So if you could check on that and let us know before our next meeting, that would be helpful. Bob?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess my concern is the contract, and maybe having the statute placed in the deed may be greater weight. But I watch the news up in Northeast Minnesota all the time, and I see the contract that the city of Duluth and the band had, and that's out on the street now. It's of no value. The courts have decided that the contract is not there. And so I just wonder about the expenditure of this on behalf of the council and whether or not we've got any guarantees.
I'm taking a look at the piece of the statute that Mr. Becker referenced. I think that you're required, not just on this but on all, to state that encumbrance in the deed that's referenced in the statute. What I'm reading, it's set out in quotes and everything, that should be part of the deed. That way, if the land is ever transferred later, that encumbrance is going to go with it. It runs with the land, and then it can't be taken away.
Mr. Chair, members, and that very well could be the case. I just tell you.
You're going to find out for us, aren't you?
But I will find out.
Sure, may continue.
Yes, please.
On the top of page 5 is another paragraph, and the last two sentences, we believe that a balanced approach to this issue requires respecting traditional Ojibwe culture. This is with regard to wolf hunting. And the last sentence says that we request that there be no wolf hunting on band property within the boundaries of the reservation. Well, that's hardly a balanced approach. It's going to be their way. And I'm concerned about that because it's one-sided. But further, the last sentence says they request. Who decides the request?
I would assume the accomplishment plan has to govern that in terms of if we accept it or not. The way this is written is not very clear. So I think we should send it back and ask for clarity. I also think we should ask the tribe to weigh in on the difference that they see, at least, between the contract for this property and what happened at the casino in Duluth, to give us some assurance so that we feel confident. I will ask staff to be sure that they address that for our December meeting. Is that all right?
Thank you.
Yep. Jim?
I just have one question for Greg. So, Greg, say that we went up to that property now and they have three storage buildings built on the property. Who actually enforces this? Is it the council's responsibility to enforce it, or who enforces this?
Mr. Chair, Jim, council doesn't have the enforcement responsibilities or rights at all. It would be the state would have to enforce it. And so since D and I would be the contract, the other contract dealer, the contractor, my understanding is leave it up to the DNR to enforce it, or through the Attorney General's office.
And who would pay for that?
Mr. Chair, Jim, that's not clear right now. How that the enforcement of these laws would be under the general authority of those entities to enforce. There would be no automatic source of money coming from somewhere else. They would have to do it under existing sources, or they would have to come back and request for new money to enforce something, some obligation that you have already out there. But you wouldn't automatically pay for it. It would be using their existing sources of money, or they could request a special appropriation to enforce the law.
I mean, Greg, this is similar to a discussion of Phil. I mean, we recommend that the state, with these funds, buy a piece of property and automatically subject to built obligation, which is a state's obligation. It doesn't come back to us. No enforcement wouldn't fall into the same category if the state has taken on that obligation and has a responsibility to manage that obligation.
The difference between those two are, what you're asking them, what they would be doing is enforcing within their existing resources, whatever they're appropriated to them. There's no place for them to get the money to enforce this without a specific appropriation for it. They would have to within their existing resources. With PILT, we have an open appropriation to pay all PILT fees. So the legislature doesn't even need to act on that. If land is acquired, that land, there's automatically money available to pay the PILT on that. There's not automatically money to pay necessarily costs. But unless Mr. Becker knows of a back door, I know the legislative auditor has a way of assessing the fund for money, but I'm not sure that the Attorney General does.
I think that not only does the legislative auditor have a way, but we have, as the council, funds available that with approval of the LCC could be used for litigation in the interest of the fund. Maybe. I'll accept that. That's been my plan, however. But I think that the whole discussion raises the question of whether or not the staff ought to sit down with nonpartisan staff from the House and the Senate, look at this situation, and come up with any revisions in statutes that clarify responsibilities regarding violations of the dedication of these lands and who enforces and maybe how it's paid. And if we can come up with rational, clear instructions, put them in statute.
Because this doesn't apply to this project alone. This is an issue for everything that we're doing. You know, who enforces, who monitors. It doesn't matter if it's the SNA program or something that Ducks Public Land or Ducks Unlimited is doing. If there's no enforcement, you know, it's all the agreements are worth nothing.
And it might be worthwhile for the staff of the legacy committee that appropriate money for land acquisition to consider whether or not other funds ought to have similar language.
Well, and what do you do about it after 25 years when there is no more source of money? Sue?
my suggestion would be kind of tagging along with what Mr. Becker said, that the legislature perhaps look at amending the statutes to put in a fee-shifting provision. So if there is a dispute that's brought, the party who loses, which is going to be the one who did the wrong thing, i.e. put the building on land that's not supposed to be there, have to pay the other party's attorney's fees and expenses, and then that money isn't actually coming out of anything because it's being reimbursed. And in Minnesota right now, unless you specifically have a fee-shifting provision, you don't get to do that. So by adding that, you patch a loophole that's probably across all acquisitions of this type.
Mm-hmm. Aren't you glad you came?
Yeah.
Ron?
But Dave, this project also raised a question in my mind, going back to when we acquire habitat land and thought it's supposed to be open to hunting as determined by the Department of Natural Resources. That was my understanding. But when we approved this project, we said, well, no, there won't be any wolf hunting because the applicant does not want any wolf hunting. And I go, wait a minute. If Nature Conservancy came in here and said, we want to buy some prairie, but by the way, we don't want any squirrel hunting, would we have that same reaction? So, and I understand, we do acquire some land in areas where there's no hunting, there is fishing, for example. But I'm a little confused by it. I mean, are we, when we acquire land that traditionally would be open to hunting as we know it, season set by the Department of Natural Resources, is that the way we do it? Or do we say we can acquire land for other applicants, but they can dictate what season's open or closed?
You look like you're asking me a question.
I am.
You know, the language is unless prohibited by law, and the sort of unknown is if tribal land is subject to unless prohibited by law. We do have, I remember a discussion with National Wildlife Refuge where they have restricted hunting to some degree on properties, and we've gotten into a discussion about that. This is a bit of a gray area, there's no question. You know, we last year did the Arboretum project, recommended that, where the municipality did not allow hunting. So...
Do you have
a palette?
Yeah. Please.
May I ask Mr. Knopf to reply to your question that, among other things, in the context of Minnesota law and federal Supreme Court case decisions.
I don't know if you got a worse deal.
You threw me a curve in there. I don't know about the U.S. Supreme Court decisions that you want to talk about.
I think just in general, do they apply to the city?
Let me try to answer Brian's question in pieces here, and we'll see if we can get to that. The first part is, you know, the Constitution provision, Dave kind of restated it not exactly, but, you know, this has to be open, land has to be open to hunting and fishing during the open season unless otherwise provided by law. A couple of years ago, you guys, as part of your recommendation, put in into law kind of a little more specificity in how that works. DNR requires it managed by DNR. So the district can close or open just the same powers he has for state land everywhere else. For U.S. Fish and Wildlife, as David mentioned, for the issues with the refuge, it's managed based on the refuge law. There's a special provision for U.S. Fish and Wildlife. And then there's the all other category. Anything not U.S. Fish and Wildlife or not state, it still says that it's open to the extent determined by the Commissioner of Natural Resources. The Commissioner didn't want to have that sole authority and negotiate with every single partner. So part of the way this works now is the Commissioner makes that decision, but the Commissioner makes it based on what's ever in the accomplishment plan. So whatever you, as a, each accomplishment permit has to have a hunting and fishing plan. So if it's going to be closed at all, it has to list it in the hunting, in the accomplishment plan. And then the commissioner will then regulate it based upon that. And so that's kind of where we're at. That was the plan a couple of years ago to set up the statute to clarify how that all works. The issue, though, is what's ever in the state law, and I don't know if this Mr. Becker's talking about, is whether, since the Fond du Lac ban is not necessarily subject to state kind of regulatory laws, some criminal laws, but they aren't necessarily subject to state law, they wouldn't necessarily be subject to that law. But they would be subject to what's ever in the contract. That's why I think it's important to have in the accomplishment plan what you want. That's where the hunting and fishing plan is supposed to be within that accomplishment.
My understanding, and I'm not a professional on this subject, I shouldn't say this, but I think there is Supreme Court decision that defines the band's rights with regard to fish and wildlife in certain places.
Well, Chair, Mr. Becker, that's 1854 treated, my understanding. I don't think that's been the Supreme Court. The 1837 is which the Supreme Court said this is the 1854 treaty area. But it is, I mean, the Fond du Lac band does have rights to a broad area of northeastern Minnesota to hunt and fish under their own regulations that are not subject to state regulations for hunting and fishing. That's what you're getting at. That is true.
And I'm getting at that piece of the Constitution that talks about state law. Under state law.
Right.
Just one other additional thing is that in an appropriation rider session law, that this can be defined related to appropriation as well. And that becomes constitutionally, you're providing it in law related to the rider. So you have the statute that's there, but in the bill, is it, you could have things defined in the bill, the session law that defines the condition.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Rick, that's an important point. A couple of years ago, what this group decided to do was to put in statute kind of a permanent law to kind of better describe how the process is going to work. But you can always, the session law can always override that or provide more specificity on how that's going to work, yes.
And you might look at Minnesota Laws 2009, the Anoka County acquisition was done precisely that way.
One more time, and that's on page 3 at the top of the page, the paragraph that speaks to the issue of the band seeking to transfer the land from fee to trust. It makes it sound as though there's a possibility that it could not happen. Although it says that the overriding objective of the federal government is to move tribal land into trust status, is that something that needs to be?
We'll ask them to address that. Thank you for pointing it out. Because I absolutely don't have an answer to that.
Just to clarify, too, I raise these questions about who decides hunting seasons. I don't raise that question because I'm questioning whether the Fond du Lac band has the right to set its own hunting and fishing seasons based on treaty rights. That's not the issue. My issue, or the issue, is who tells me when an unband member, when they can hunt in this land or not. And what they can hunt or not. That's the question.
For my land, I could tell.
You could.
Unless I got money for one.
We're ready to go to a different
one. Well, I think we're ready to go to a different one.
We have a question on Highlands, Sands, Aquifer, FA05.
We're in the FA. We're off today.
And I see Mr. Peterson's here, so.
Yeah, please come forward.
dependency. I have to apologize. I'm going to have to leave relatively quickly. Mr. Peterson, you know, we had quite a bit of discussion about this when we were considering it. And since that, those meetings, we've had some meetings in the House about conversion of forest land to potato production. And I believe there's been some discussion about, you know, our commissioner has the authority for approving wells, irrigation wells for potato production. And we had some discussion about degradation of groundwater with conversion that will occur automatically. So my question is, how, with these properties, are you buffering areas? Are you making the acquisitions where you're, on one hand, purchasing a tract, and then next to it, you're, the DNR is approving an irrigation well that will facilitate conversions?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I think it varies by parcel. Again, our selection of parcels was determined first and foremost by their value as habitat and the benefits they provided otherwise for access to public properties. So some of these properties, for example, the proposed SMA in Hubbard County, I believe to the north of that property is an existing irrigated potato. So that tract specifically would have would fit into that situation, I think.
Mr. Chair, I understand, I think we have a discussion about the threat, but the threat of conversion is facilitated by approval of the irrigation to enable the conversion. So you could stop the conversion by not approving the irrigation. There's no requirement that you have to approve. You can look at that. So I think it'd be maybe if we have some specific, you don't have to do this right now, but if there's recently approved irrigation near these tracks, or if there are permit requests, it would be good to know that. I'm uncomfortable spending public money to protect something that doesn't have to be there if public was improving facilitation of the threat to convert.
Yeah, I don't know what to do. This is a huge issue. It's an important issue. It's a water quality issue. But it's a bit of a pop a hit a mole, whack a mole kind of deal. Because as soon as you take this parcel out of circulation by buying and protecting it, the attention moves to the adjoining parcel, and you really haven't solve the problem, because we don't have enough money to just take everything off the table, and the value is greater than the fair market value. If your desire is potatoes, if it's for anybody else, it's a different valuation. And so we have a huge appraisal issue in terms of being able to have a value high enough to justify purchasing the property because of that unique concentration focus. So it's a really tough issue.
And I agree that it's a real tough issue, but we have had public testimony that conversion leads to degradation. We have, since 1989, a statute that says that you cannot degrade groundwater. So if you have pristine, we also have testimony that in this area there's pristine shallow groundwater and you convert the property, and it automatically degrades it, then we have to look at some other tools of enforcement rather than coming to the public fund to pay for trying to catch up to this. It's a very big issue that I think we're going to have a discussion about.
Mr. Chair, members, maybe I'll just add one more comment. I think a lot of these tracks, regardless of the pressure of conversion or threat of conversion, would still be highly desirable to protect. And again, I'll reference this particular SNA. We have literally no protected jackpine woodland communities of this quality and extent protected through the SNA system. And so it would be desirable to protect that regardless of other issues on its border. I think that's true of other of the parcels that we've identified. Certainly, you know, the threat is helping drive this faster than we might otherwise. But I think we've gone through a very, as I described earlier during the briefing a few months ago, we've done a very comprehensive analysis of 60,000 acres and have identified a few thousand acres of which we were interested in, had not high natural resource values. And the 2,800 acres that we initially proposed were kind of the best of the best. And that was tempered in part by the risk of threat of conversion. But the overriding benefit was related to natural resource values and access values.
Dane?
Dick, jackpine forests, do they provide exclusive habitat for fish, game, or wildlife, and if so, what?
Well, I think it's not simply a jackpine forest. It's a particular type of community with jackpine as a tree species, but it's more of a more open type community that has a higher degree of biodiversity in the flora. So there's a lot of rare understory plants.
Such as?
That are associated with this particular community.
Can you name some of them? I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I'm trying to get a picture in my mind, and specifically for fish, game, and wildlife.
There is a, I'll probably miss it, but a globe thistle. There's a thistle that is a rare, it's not the common weedy type, but there's a particular thistle that is associated with these types of communities. You know, beyond that, we sent the department head plant ecologist on site to do a comprehensive review of this particular site. Very high quality, desirable track to put in decimate status. Fauna, I don't know if there's any threatened or rare fauna. I know that the rarity is mostly associated with the flora.
Okay. Thank you. Any other accomplishment plans that members would like to bring up, discuss? Ask proposers questions on. This is not your last shot at it. Staff has recommended, as you'll see in agenda item 11, a motion that is that we move the council, that the council move forward with a bill accomplishing recommending appropriations from the Outdoor Heritage Fund based on the accomplishment plans we've discussed and directed today. This just gives them an indication to go forth preparing the bill, subject to all of the discussions and stuff that we need to come back and discuss at our next meeting. Someone's willing to make that motion. Tom, thank you. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. So we'll be back in December to address the specific issues. Dave, you're here. We went ahead without you and moved you around. Sorry to now make you wait, but please come forward. The issue is agenda item 10, direct support services authorization and limits.
There's an agenda item memo in your packet. That agenda item memo contains the current language that we use. There's a background piece that identifies the general concern that we have. The back of the memo shows the funds that we're talking about now. And there is reading material that you have all before, but that we thought we would make sure you had at your fingertips. The legislative auditor's report that addresses on page 45, I believe it is, thereabouts. The support services question. And the MMB guidance agencies on legacy fund expenditures, which came out of the Office of the Legislative Auditor's report. So, Mr. Shad is here to answer questions, and the item is an item that was brought to my attention by Council Member Cox. So maybe Jim would like to
have a word.
Okay, sure. Well, I think everyone knows that last year we approved, I'm going to call it indirect expenses, to the Department of Natural Resources. Since that time, other partners have requested indirect expenses. Currently, the system we have is, well, first of all, I should say that, you know, 5 years into this project or this experiment with this legacy amendment, it's becoming apparent that indirect expenses are becoming an issue for everyone. And I don't think anyone can expect to successfully spend $100 million a year and not have overhead expenses. It's just not going to happen. So again, last year we approved it for the DNR. Other groups are starting to ask it. So I think it's time that the council has a recommendation that we recognize the problem and we have a policy, a consistent policy for everybody that comes forward to us. Currently, the way we're doing it is, other than the DNR, groups that have requested these expenses, our grant administrator, the Department of Natural Resources, makes a determination whether these expenses are applicable or not. That seems odd to me that the group that we've already given this money to is now making the determination whether other groups coming forward, whether those expenses are applicable or not. So I think it's time we come forward with a standard policy to have the DNR receive these expenses. I mean, puts them at a competitive advantage. Here, one of the real ideas behind this whole council was that it would be a competitive process, that the person who did the work, the best, the most inexpensive, so on and so forth, would get the money. So to give it to certain groups and not to other groups puts these other groups, I think, at a competitive advantage. So it's my hope that we can get a policy here together that it's a standardized policy that everyone understands, that we can see when people bring us their projects to us, that we can easily identify what these expenses are and go from there. I think there's a couple of ways we could do this. We could we could talk it over amongst the council here and come up with a plan. We could have a subset of the council and come up with a plan, or we could hire somebody, an accountant or somebody of that nature, that would look at the groups that we have coming before us, understand the work they're doing, and come up with an equitable system for allowing these expenses. So that's pretty much where I'm coming from.
And Jim and I have talked about this, and it's at best confusing, and everybody's interpretation of direct and necessary is going to be different. I would tell you, I think Jim's right, we need to decide for ourselves what direct and necessary are, what we want to allow and not allow, and come up with a strategy that going forward, and I'm not talking about the stuff that we're looking at right now, because I think the horse is out of the barn, but certainly for next year, we have a strategy and make it very clear to everyone. And my thought on this was that we convene an executive committee meeting open to anybody else to spend more time than this council is going to spend today to try to wrestle this to the ground, bring it back to the full council with a recommendation on how we do this. Because I think Jim's absolutely right. You know, we're doing it for the DNR. We've had others ask. There is a fairness thing at play here, and there's a consistency thing that we ought to strive for so that we don't have to have this discussion time and time again. So, Jane, we will let you talk to
you. I also agree, and I would solicit opinions of the partners as to what their position is, what should be included and what not, and to substantiate it, that we could use that as fodder
at
for
least
the
start of
fodder
the discussion.
For the mill.
So, Dave, what's your opinion?
Well, first of all, for the record, Dave Shepp, Deputy Commissioner at DNR, and me as a Amanda Graver, a grants manager, she's been working with some of these other organizations to figure out these costs and what is appropriate. As I've discussed with the council in the past, I think the state agencies are somewhat unique here in that. We get our funding appropriated for very specific purposes, and unless we have dollars that are funded or appropriated by the legislature to help support getting outdoor heritage dollars or projects on the ground, we don't have the resources to provide and pay for these support costs, and they're very real costs, as Jim mentioned. But we are understanding and know that the other organizations that are participating with us or partners have the same challenges that we do. I think a lot of the organizations in the first couple of years here, with the excitement of the new legacy funds, were willing to kind of eat those costs and try to figure out how to use their own resources or do fundraising as a way to support getting these dollars on the ground. But I think they're realizing that that's increasingly difficult, and that's unlimited. I think we have been funding some of their support costs. We did a lot of work with DU and their financial staff at Bismarck to kind of understand how they pay for these costs and tease out what's appropriate and what meets the definition of directly related to and necessary for. We now have the Nature Conservancy bringing forward a proposal, and Amanda and Heather and others have spent quite a bit of time, again, trying to kind of figure out how PNC does business and figuring out these costs. And so I think Jim's point is a good one, is that this is very complicated, and I think we can continue to work with each organization and kind of figure this out organization by organization and project by project. And we will continue to do that as part of our responsibilities for contract management here. But
I think there might be some merit in looking at a more standardized approach, and we would not be opposed to that. We have had other appropriations provided to us with by the legislature that provides limits on the amount of administrative costs or these kinds of costs. So it's not an unusual thing to take that approach, kind of that flat rate approach. I do think a couple of considerations. One is that we have found that the support costs vary considerably depending on the nature of the project. And so we take a look at each project, the nature of each project. For example, if it's one large acquisition, we're not going to hire anybody. There's no IT support costs. There's probably one financial transaction there, so very low burden on our financial folks. And so in that case, we have brought forward these correct and necessary costs at a very low rate, maybe at 0% or 1%, because that single transaction is not putting much burden on our support services. In other cases, and our Craftsman Management proposal is a good example of that, we're hiring a bunch of staff, they've all got vehicles, they need access to the network, and so we've got HR costs, they're doing a lot of contracting, so there's a lot of financial management work there, and most costs are closer to 8%. And so I think the danger in setting one rate is that in some cases we might be paying more than what would be appropriate for that project. In other cases, it might be significantly underestimating those support costs. And so I think looking at some categories of projects or kind of classifying projects based on whether they put a lot of demand on our organization's resources or a minimal demand on those resources would be an important consideration for the council to take into account there.
Other council members' thoughts on this? Would it be okay at some point to pull an executive committee together to spend the morning talking to the DNR and other groups to try to come up with some standardization of this that we could recommend to the whole group? I don't like using the executive committee, but I think it's a good group, and we invite everybody to participate so that if others want to, it would be welcome. Is that all right with everyone? Does that seem like a reasonable strategy? I'm seeing nods, so we'll do that. You'll certainly be invited to the meeting. You're happy to help out. All right, thanks very much. With that, we'll move to item number 12, Comprehensive Plan Approval for Habitat Protection in Dakota County. Bill, do you want to say a word?
There is an action item memo explaining this. I'll just briefly say that staff requested withholding approval of this until Dakota County completed some status reports and final reports that they were behind on, and they had been completed and are in the system and we're up to date. So we're recommending approval so they can go forward with their program. Mr. Singer is here if people have questions about the accomplishment plan itself. The accomplishment plan is attached to the action item group.
So, does anyone have any questions on the accomplishment plan as presented? Would someone like to make a motion to approve it as submitted? Thank you for making that motion. Any discussion on this? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Thanks for coming, Al. Thank you.
It's the easiest presentation I've
ever. We're saving up again. Item 13 is the biennial versus annual recommendation study. As you all know, We were charged by the legislature to take a look at our process and specifically whether or not the annual or biennial process made more sense for us. We contracted with Minnesota Management Analysis or Management Analysis. We asked you guys to do some work. You've talked to people and you come back with a report which you're going to highlight today, and then we'll open it up to discussion.
Good morning. I'm Kirby Pittman with Management Analysis and Development. We're part of and this is my colleague Ralph Brown. So the report that you have is in response to the legislative request that the council examine transitioning to a biennial recommendation process. This project was very limited in scope. We were not asked to do an assessment of the council or its funding system. The report is limited to examining the difference between the annual versus the biennial recommendation cycle. The council's role in this process is to make that recommendation as stated in the legislation. Our role is to assist the council in making that recommendation by providing information. To that end, we have gathered relevant data and arrived at conclusions based on analysis, but have tried to develop conclusions without making a recommendation ourselves. This has been a bit of a tight wire act in that the data we examined led to several, a series of conclusions that our poll strongly suggest one cycle over another. So while we may have not made overt recommendations, the evidence does seem to point in that direction. Our process in developing this report involved reviewing relevant documents, including procedural documents of the council minutes, legislative hearing reports, legislative hearing records, and legislative auditor reports, as well as reviewing, we interviewed about 36 stakeholders, including current and former council members, council staff, people involved in the formation of the council, legislative and state agency staff, and stakeholder organizations. I just want to make a couple points about the structure of the report. We see this report as a tool for the council to get you to your own recommendation, but also as a document that encapsulates the history and issues involved in this question of annual versus biennial, so that it can be used in the future as this issue is likely to come up again. Therefore, this report tries to briefly but comprehensively cover basic background and content of the issue in one document, so you will not have to start from scratch if it arises again. Another point I want to make about the structure is on page 23, there is a long list of pros and cons for each biennial and annual cycle. We gathered that from all of our research and all of our interviews, and we chose not to distill and summarize that information too much so that it's sort of this raw data for you to look at and as comprehensive as possible. So, again, that list is on at the end of the report on page 23. In terms of the analysis, as we distilled the information we gathered, five overarching questions surfaced. And if you go to page 15, the discussion about those questions starts there. We provided a summary response to each of those questions. And our hope is that these questions give you a framework for arriving at your own recommendation, and then you're able to ground that and articulate that rationale based on this framework. That was brief, but at this point we'd like just to take questions you have about the report, and also say that if you, I'm not sure what your process is at this point, but if you choose to delay your decision until December, we would be happy to come back and help facilitate that conversation at that point, so we're available to do that if that's helpful for you. So, questions?
So, you know, the question that I have, just to kick this off, is, on one hand you have annual, on the other you have biennial, and then you have this hybrid. And when I think about it, the hybrid is the most difficult one because you don't know how to divide it in a strategy that tells you specifically what you would do in year two and what you would take off the table. And, there's some appeal to saying things that you continue year after year, you just do once and for all in the biennium and you're done with it, but you don't know what's coming. So I'm wondering if in your conversations with people, anyone offered you really concrete, good suggestions for how a hybrid might possibly be construed that would avoid that sort of unknown of what isn't. I mean, the advantage of the annual is that you don't know exactly what's going to come and you can react. In a hybrid, you would have to assume you kind of knew that and how you manage that. And so I'm wondering what you heard that would be helpful as we think this through in regard to the hybrid strategy.
Mr. Chair, you may recall at the last meeting I started to allude to this briefly in my presentation, trying to forewarn you that this is part of the conversation. A lot of the folks we talked to did see value in both an annual approach and a biennial approach, and the sense was, gosh, isn't there someone we can pull all those values into some kind of variation or a hybrid approach? And so there was a lot of interest in doing that, but I would say that we weren't provided with a model of how this might be done, but almost everyone had a different model about how this might be done. And frankly, I don't know that we're in a position to really assess which ones really work well or don't. What we did hear was that a couple of categories, I'd say. One is people who gave us precise suggestions, 75% of the money in year one and 25% in year two, things of that nature. The other approach was more of a varied approach, saying, well, you know, basically go with an annual, but give yourself the option of treating something biennially. And often those folks would point to the Blandin project as an example of where that actually has happened in the past. At the same time that there was people expressing a sort of a general interest and basically kind of saying, whatever you decide, keep your mind open for changes later. In addition, we did hear a pushback as well. And the pushback to having a hybrid, the sense that one of the real concerns is trying to make this appear, not just to be in a really open, fair process in terms of applying for funds. The process is open and fair, but it has to appear that way as well. If you create a hybrid and start handling things in different ways, you know, this kind of project would be a biennial consideration, this an annual, that adds, anything you do that adds complexity to it is going to make the system seem more complicated. And that might have a tendency to scare away, in a sense, some possible applicants. The argument was made that also that if you do tend to make some kind of consideration of some projects being considered biennially, others annually, what's likely would tend to happen, and I can't verify this, but the sense was that what would likely tend to happen is the older, more established groups would tend to be in the biennial category, and it might appear to be an unfair advantage to groups who are just coming into the process. So there was a pushback to the whole notion as well, saying at this time, the more any change, any hybrid you make is going to add some apparent complexity to the process, and the simpler you can keep it at this point, the better in terms of public understanding.
Okay. That's clear as mud. No,
you know, in all seriousness, what you talked about is internally what I struggled with in thinking about a hybrid. How do you draw the line? And you didn't get any clarity. So that's that's what I was asking, is if anybody had given you clarity on that. Your answer is what I feared. Other questions about the report, the work that's done, and thoughts in terms of annual versus biennial?
When I look at the extent of this study and the legislature's concern with having this study being done, I'm wondering if the intent is for us to choose one or the other, or a hybrid, that will continue for years and years, versus choosing on a yearly basis. Is choosing on a yearly basis still an option, or was the intent for us to choose for 5 to 10 years as to, well, we're going to go biennial or we're going to go annual? And I guess maybe the members need to tell me that as much as what, you know, what you found out.
Well, let me clarify. Currently, we have been asked by the legislature to do annual. And we were asked to look at whether or not we would recommend to the legislature a change of that from annual to a biennial or a hybrid of some sort. And that's our charge to do. As long as we're directed by the legislature to do a specific thing, it's not our choice. It's our recommendation. So we could recommend staying with annual and then 2 years later come back and say, gee, we've rethought it, would you let us do it on a biennial basis? But it's not completely up to us where we're at today. Does that help?
Well, I guess I'm wondering the intent. Was the intent to allow us flexibility and change, or was the intent to say, okay, you're biennial now? Like, you know, the other funds are just considered in the legacy fund, considered biennial. Whereas you look at another grant-giving agency that does some of the same types of things we do, LCCMR, and they choose every year. And it could be one or the other. So I'm thinking that maybe the legislature wanted us to choose one or the other. And I don't know what their intent was, but that was the feeling that I had. And we would stick with it for a while. We wouldn't say in 2 years, well, let's change our mind.
I think that's safe to say that this is a please recommend to us what you think going forward.
For the long term, yes.
Okay. You can always change your mind.
Mr. Chair, I think the hybrid that was mentioned, an example of it being the Blandin situation, is probably just that exception, and indeed there may be another one that, because of contracts and circumstances, have to be done in that particular way. But I'm not sure there will be. You know, that would have been a huge percentage of very early in our history to be doing that big a project that would take that big a percentage of the annual of our annual income, so or appropriation. So, you know, I don't look at that as a I do look at that as an exception that we can do on kind of a biennial basis, but I don't like to look at it as the rule. I would favor the annual.
So, before we make a recommendation, I know Rick had to leave early because of a circumstance he couldn't control, and Scott and Bill aren't here. I'd like to bring this back in December before we make a specific recommendation. I'd also like to ask Phyllis if you'd like to say something about this, since you were the one who brought it up and directed us to think about it. I think it would be helpful to get your perspective.
Thank you.
thanks for the request. I was the one who did suggest doing this. Of course, I've now had one whole year of experience now with dealing with legacy funds, and I actually see, you know, kind of when we look at problems coming up that could be handled with some of the other funds, it would be kind of nice to have a more annual process.
Okay.
To deal with the orchestra grant this year as opposed to last year.
Somebody's paving the way for us.
But one of the one of the things, again, as we were wrestling with the kind of decisions that we were making last year, and also I'm not on LCCMR, but I was on LCMR for many years, including a couple of times as chair of LCMR. And one of the problems that you see with the decisions that are made, and it always frustrated me with LCMR, is that you're, at that point, we had the decisions all made in the summer. And for the most part, they just went totally as we made them. We messing around a little bit in the session on to the final, last few days of session. And because somebody or the other body was using them as a bargaining point for something or the other, even though at the end it was just the way we said it, should be done. Frustration to me was this kind of, natural resources have a natural cycle. And when you don't pass it, but it doesn't take effect until July, you've kind of lost a large part of that natural cycle. Now, what happens in the continuing process is, particularly if the appropriations don't cancel and they can go on, then, you've still got the old ones to work on before you get the new ones. But I still, it's kind of as we were wrestling with the appropriations last year, still appreciate the hybrid model as I think the best one to do, and I think the decision should be made each time as you're looking at your appropriations. I think you can look at them and you can look at the histories and you can look at some of the ones that make an awful lot of sense to continue for 2 years, and to have much more energy put into oversight of those rather than the process of new application. We did see one issue, and this was in an arts appropriation over the last year, where this was a biennial, one of the biennial applications, but you kind of, the person who had it had to do a renewal mid-year cycle, and there was a screw up on that. It was a question of getting it in one day late, and the question is whose computer didn't work, and that kind of thing. The whole process, and it was a big appropriation to a big group, and so there were two parts of that. One, it was a big amount of money, but they were so big that they could also work around not having it for a while. But there was an enormous amount of expense, legal expense on both sides, as to whether they deserved it or whether this was bad enough so that they shouldn't get their second year. It finally went to a hearing examiner that decided in favor of the group and against the state arts board, which to my not looking at it immediately, there's a little bit of doubt and there's some problem about whose computer was working. And it wasn't a new application. It was just kind of the continuation of something you had already decided. Yeah, just go ahead and do it. I mean, unless there's something wrong with the stuff that they've submitted. Don't use this technicality to say, well, you were in the kitchen in the morning instead of in the night. And of course, to the manager of the fund, you've been managing these funds for so long, why didn't you put it in a week in advance and call to make sure it had gotten there? I mean, it's the kind of thing where you can find everybody wrong and nobody right. So there is, and I'm just going back 100 years ago to my main reason for the, when I first ran for the legislature, I was working on grants that I had gotten while I was at the University of Minnesota. and I believe this fallacy, they tell you that the legislature, even if you're really interested in doing stuff, is a part-time job. So I thought I could do both at once, and my final decision that I couldn't do both at once was when I came to one of these almost automatic renewal of a grant that I was supposed to do. No, I just didn't have time to do the grant. And I decided, okay, if I don't have time to write the grant, I clearly am not going to have time to pay the attention to the research I should be.
I'm sure it wasn't really 100 years ago.
It seems like 100 years ago now. But anyway, that so what I kind of think is I think that you ought to not totally reject the idea of some biennial appropriation. I think as you're deciding things, or as we look at your recommendation, remember this doesn't even start until the next biennium. So, no. So what I think that you want to do is in the next cycle, so it's the next cycle of applications. We're not looking at these at all. I think you want to look at ones with a sort of open mind. Which ones make sense to go for 2 years? You're essentially going to have, because you now have a history to look back on, you're going to have an application that's going to be very much the same in the second year, maybe with little bits of details, and save something. I like the idea of saving some proportion of what you're doing and wait until your application's coming next year to decide how much that should be for annual redecision making. But I just think you'll have more fun if you get more time to look over projects instead of just shuffling papers all the time. That's my point.
Okay. Any questions for Phyllis? Thank you. So we'll come back to this in a second. Next is 2009 final report overview.
Mr. Chair, I kind of think that prepared this. One of the things that's really struck me 5 years down the road, when we're finally able to look at our first year of appropriations, it's a long time. It takes a long time to get this money on the ground. I think you'll find it interesting what we've discovered, and taking a few minutes worth while. 2009 project managers are here. If you have a question that you might want to pose to anyone in particular or the group in general, they would be happy to answer it. Heather, do you want to take it away?
Thank you, Bill, members of council. This is an opportunity for us to take a look at the first year's appropriations. For the most part, those appropriations have completed the work that was described in their accomplishment plan. There are three, however, that are outstanding, and they had their appropriations extended due to the leveraging of federal funds. Talking to each of those project managers, all of them were here today, so we can also ask them questions in any regard. But those appropriations will be filing their final reports within the next several weeks, actually probably by the end of the calendar year. There's really great news associated with the first year appropriations. I think we should all be very proud of the work that folks have done here today and out in the field, because the impact, I think, is fairly substantial. And for the most part, we have really exceeded the expectations of the proposed accomplishment plan as originally described back in 2009. So one of the things that I want to make sure that everybody understands is that just a little bit of history and how quickly these appropriations had to get off the ground. As you know, the amendment was passed in November of 2008. The bill was signed several months later, in May of 2009, and then passed in 2008. Appropriations were made available just 6 weeks later on the 1st of July. So we're talking about an extremely short turnaround time of people having to get proposals together, submit them, have them vetted by a council, and then be on the ground by the 1st of July. And I think that's extraordinary in terms of the timeline, and extraordinary in terms of the accomplishments that were made within the last 5 years. At that time, we used programs, programmatic programs were funded for a little bit over $85.5 million. That figure does not include contract management or administrative expenses. We convened a group of project managers from 2009, a couple of weeks ago, and asked them to talk to us a little bit about the lessons that we learned, because I think it's really important for major programs to have an opportunity to look back and say, well, what did we learn that first year, given the quick timeline, given the constraints in which we were operating. And so I just tabulated some of the comments that people gave. One of the things that we found important in 2009, and I would argue is important today, is that projects that are shovel ready are really critical to the successful completion, timely completion of programs, and those that are built upon feasibility systems also are the key point. Readiness, again, is a really key and important point, and appropriating the ongoing programs that supplement and support existing efforts, again, is really a key learning experience. Project managers report that the phasing of programs has been critical in helping to build familiarity with the people with whom they work in the field, especially around land acquisition, and also in stability in keeping and hiring and retaining good and productive staff. What we did find, however, and this should not be too surprising, is that the success that was had, particularly in certain habitat types, really varied due to a number of different factors, including weather, land prices, contractor availability, and workforce capacity. Some of those issues have been mitigated over time, particularly in terms of the private sector and contractors who are able and willing to do the work, and certainly in terms of workforce capacity as agencies and organizations have been able to build up that core staff and competency. Weather, of course, has been variable over the last several years, and it really has impacted restoration and enhancement programs, and land prices as well. Particularly in various parts of the state, we've seen dramatic increases in the price of certainly agricultural land that has impacted the ability to acquire land, key pieces of land. Project managers also reported that financial and institutional infrastructures are sometimes inadequate for the reporting that is required under statute and certainly for the accounting of expenditures. And in some cases, those issues have been dealt with. We still struggle from time to time when we have requests from legislature, legislative staff, or legislators regarding certain key components. Sometimes folks have a difficult time having to go back and parse apart that information as being requested, but I think overall people have done a very good job of being able to report back what is being asked of them. Everyone reported that the addition of the Outdoor Heritage Fund has really raised the bar in terms of the quality and the extent of the restoration enhancements. This work has been going on for some time, but certainly the addition of the funds has enabled people to do a more deep and qualitative kind of restoration. And I think that has certainly been supported in at least the first initial restoration evaluation that was done by the Department of Natural Resources. One of the great things about the Outdoor Heritage Fund, I would argue, is that there's been a high rate of cooperation and collaboration across governmental and non-governmental organizations, and we see this interconnectedness and ever-increasing, to an ever-increasing degree each year as requests come in. And I think those partnerships have been very valuable in extending and leveraging the impact of the Outdoor Heritage Fund. And finally, everyone, I think, agrees that while the outputs are clear, we can certainly count the acres and talk about the dollars expended, but I think where we need to do more work is really talking about the outcomes. And certainly the five-year mark offers us an opportunity to do so, but as we go forward, I think we will need to really think harder and longer about how we measure the long-term impact of the investment of these dollars. In the packet of material provided is a listing of each of the appropriations, the agency to whom the appropriation was directed, the amount appropriated, and what the status is. As I indicated, there are three outstanding appropriations with very small balances totaling less than $150,000. Also included are two tables that talk about the acres affected of those reported to date and the financials. before today, and I want to make sure that everybody understands that these numbers don't appear to be all of that impressive because of one very large appropriation that is still yet to file its final report, and that's Force for the Future. So take it and get this here and certainly can speak to that as well. But once we add in the dollars expended, $36 million for that program, as well as the acres, which is close to $190,000, these figures are going to look absolutely tremendous. So at that time, probably the beginning of the year, when we have all the final reports finally tabulated, I will come back to you with updated information that will, I think, really show a dramatic impact of the funds. One of the things I did want to say, though, to this extent, of the reports that have been filed, we do know that there has been some return back to the fund, and I would emphasize that the fund is not expended, do return to the outer heritage fund to be reappropriated. The dollar amount right now appears to be about $3,125,400. Those funds should show up on the next statement that we receive in this forecast in December, and we will continue to monitor that with the agencies and with MMB. But overall, of those agencies and organizations that have filed reports, they have expended 92% of the fund out. So with that, I will stand for questions and also invite you to question individual project managers who are here representing the programs that were funded under Minnesota Law 2000.
Anybody have questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Heather, I'm wondering if you could tell me, I'm assuming TUI, the Northern Tallgrass Prairie, it looks like that was completely canceled. Is that 1.583 part of the 3+ million?
No, that's not included in that case, because that was already considered a couple of years ago when that money was canceled.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Heather, where is the 3.125 coming from, and why are they being returned?
Money is being returned from the Accelerated Prairie and Grassland Management Program, also from a small bit from the Prairie Heritage, Mississippi River Blufflands. The largest component is from the RIM WRP program, which is about a little over $2 million. The Conservation Partners Legacy Grant Program, Dakota County Habitat Protection Program also had to turn back money. So it is those.
Will that be detailed in December?
I can certainly provide you with the figures. I have a tabulation here. I did not include that in the report.
There are really two big projects and a bunch of, you know, really small amounts. They just couldn't round up to that amount. I mean, you know, if you're doing a land acquisition and you've got $40,000 left, but you don't have any projects that are less than $40,000, you're going to turn that one back. The real question is the two projects, one of which was a timing misunderstanding.
Correct.
In terms of Dakota County, where they thought something under contract was okay, but it turned out to have to be completed by, and that was $600,000?
That was about $300,000.
$300,000. And then the RIM money, they just couldn't get enough money on the ground in the time frame and turned back about $2 million. Those are the
not
two
enough,
big ones.
Not enough sellers?
We would have to ask them. So why didn't you spend all our money? Not our money. Why didn't you spend all the money you were allocated? Recommended by us and allocated by the legislature.
Mr. Chairman and council members, Tim Kohler from the Board of Water and Soil Resources. And we, as a final report, and they have copies of the final reports yet, or they will, and it's in the final report, it explains kind of what happened. And, a couple of specific things happened to us in the first year. We were challenge was trying to figure out how to manage the funds. And way before me, the indication was that we could roll our phase one money to phase two, and maybe our phase two money to phase three, and just kind of roll with appropriations. We later, just about a year ago or so, found out that we couldn't do that, that the appropriations were specific to the year and the appropriation language. So a little over $1 million fell into that pot. We also had a situation where the state diverted from one financial system to another financial system, and that was where almost another $1 million changed hands between the systems and was lost. When I say lost, the challenge is for us, and a couple people have mentioned it already, once we pass the encumbrance deadline date, we can't do new encumbrances. So when these two major issues were discovered, we were already past September 30th of 2012, which was our deadline date to do encumbrances. So even though we had another $20 or $30 million worth of projects we could have funded, we weren't able to go back and kind of reopen the appropriation to a line. Sorry for all the accountants in the room. I'm probably not using the exact right terms. But those are the two main issues. We did also have a couple of cancellations prior to today, but after the encumbrance date also, which again put in about a couple $100,000 back into the pot and caused us once again, because we were past the deadline date, we can't reuse that money. So that's where we are today. I might want to just add one really important point is that now that we've gotten all of that straightened out, our balances on phase two right now are basically at zero. Our balances at our phase three funding are basically at zero, and we're well into our phase four funding. So I'm sitting here telling you that I'm not going to be here next year at this time, telling you I have another $2 million to turn back to you.
We appreciate both that we have $2 million to allocate and that you're never going to do it again. Other questions? Kenny?
So if I understand right, this $3.125 million, when would that be available in next year's appropriation? Probably would be the way that would show up.
We believe it'll be in the fund statement that we see at our December meeting.
And Mr. Chair, if I may ask Mr. Kohler, this got turned back and you're able to spend it now and it was RIM, that part specifically. Is the new money now, do we know, or is this a Farm Bill question, if there's federal match available, if there awards more money for RIM? I guess I was just thinking if that's what got turned back or if do we not know that?
Mr. Chairman, members, and Representative McNamara, as I mentioned before, we're about almost done with our phase four money. So the money we just got in July, we haven't quite started working on yet, and we're waiting to do a sign up on. And we are at this point treading water to wait and see what happens with the federal farm bill. So anybody's guess is as good as mine, I guess, on that, whether there's going to be an extension or a new farm bill. And in both options, if either of those things happen, we're planning on doing a RIMWRP sign-up and continuing to get applications. So I obviously would not want to venture to see when we're going to get a farm bill or an extension of the farm bill. But right now, that's kind of where we are. So we're planning on having money available from the federal government to do another sign-up. Date is to be determined. Hopefully, will be late winter and early spring of this coming year.
Other questions? I just would thank everybody who did the work. We made you come to the table very quickly and think through how to do this. As Heather mentioned, our partners did an amazing job of in very quick order figuring out how to work with us. And you did amazing work, and thank you very much for that. And thanks to the staff for figuring out how to make the process get to the point where it did, where we saw what actually was accomplished. It's something we can all do.
So, thank you. Last is an opportunity for the public to address the council. I hit Garrett and Mark Johnson from the Deer Hunters Association wanted to say something. Is there, oh, Phyllis, you want to make public?
I'm not sure I'm qualified as a member of the public. Right.
These twice in a day?
I know. It's first one. I just wanted to do a little numerical, Mr. Chairman, members, I wanted to do a little numerical addendum onto your discussion again of the wolf hunting on the property. Just want to always, every time this is being considered, I would like everyone to have it in mind. It's a computation I didn't do myself, I relied on staff for. But the amount of territory that we're talking about is roughly 3 millionth of 1% of the amount of land in the state open to wolf hunting. So I think that's what, when one thinks about the size of this problem, that's a good number.
Okay.
That's all I want to say.
All right. That's quite a calculation. You've got a calculator with a lot of decimals. Anyone else? Great. We stand adjourned. We'll see you all in December.
3 millionth of 1%.
3 millionth of 1%. I got to memorize that one.